on Senate Bill 1205, and we'll be missing one member this evening. Earl Tarno has been ill, so he won't be here today, but the rest of the committee should join us shortly, as they were here at 5:15 for our other hearing. We'll begin the testimony tonight with proponents. The first half an hour will be dedicated to the proponents, the second half an hour to those who oppose, and then we'll open it up for public testimony. So, John DiLorenzo and Mike Parno, you come forward, please.
Commented, this reminded me a little bit of the divorcement hearing that we had last session, except we needed four other hearing rooms to fill the people. Divorcement dealt with the issue between gasoline dealers and large oil companies and who should own and not own stations. And some familiar faces here, but each side presented some wonderful testimony, and we even had computerized photographs and family portrait. So
I wish you hadn't brought that up. Tom Gallagher just now started talking again.
I really wish you hadn't brought that up. Well, Mr. DiLorenzo, if you'd identify yourself, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Hagen, Dye, Hershey, and DiLorenzo in Portland. Also with me this evening is Mr. Michael Farnell, an attorney with my firm whose practice emphasizes insurance recovery in the environmental context. We are appearing here this evening on behalf of our client, ICN Pharmaceuticals, Inc., in support of Senate Bill 1205. By way of background, in the mid-70s, ICN purchased the United Medical Laboratories operation near the Portland International Airport. United Medical Laboratories operated the nation's largest mail-order pathology laboratory at the site beginning in 1961. ICN ran the laboratory facility from approximately 1972 until 1979. All operations were terminated in late 1979. Another business concern by the name of Drum Recovery, Inc. operated a drum recycling and waste disposal business in the early 1980s across the street from the ICN lab. Among other things, Drum Recovery shipped hazardous waste materials generated by others to appropriate landfills. During the course of their operation, Drum Recovery was short of working capital and had been locked out of numerous hazardous waste landfills. As a result, the principals of Drum Recovery began employing creative and illegal ways of disposing of their hazardous waste. The principals of Drum Recovery were indicted for federal environmental crimes involving dumping sodium hydroxide on playgrounds and depositing transformers containing PCBs on the ICN property. On this indictment, one of the principals served a significant amount of time in federal prison, and two others were placed on probation. Drum Recovery happened to have in its possession a significant number of drums containing TCE, or trichloroethylene, destined for disposal somewhere. TCE is thought by many to be a carcinogen and a very dangerous product. In the early 1990s, the Portland Development Commission was interested in the acquisition of the ICN site and conducted a number of environmental studies which indicated the presence of contaminated soils and other environmental concerns that could be attributed to the laboratory's operations. Because ICN had an interest in selling the property and given the fact that contaminated soils were present, ICN approached the Department of Environmental Quality and volunteered to enter into a cleanup agreement under DEQ supervision. ICN was accepted into the voluntary cleanup program and immediately began addressing the problem. The department divided the site into five operable areas, four of which have been completely remediated to DEQ's satisfaction. However, during the course of its remedial investigation, ICN discovered, much to its horror, that there were significant quantities of TCE and two of TCE's breakdown products, DCE and vinyl chloride, in the vicinity of ICN's dry well. The large quantities of TCE appeared to have contaminated the Tualatin gravel aquifer, which was a shallow aquifer which is separated by a fairly significant clay confining layer from what is called the Tualatin sandstone aquifer. This is the aquifer from which the city of Portland derives its backup water supply for the Bull Run Reservoir. ICN did not use TCE or any of its breakdown products in any appreciable quantities in the course of its operations. It was also apparent that ICN's predecessor, United Medical Laboratories, had no use for any appreciable quantities of TCE in its other operations other than cleaning small electric motor parts. It was further apparent that Drum Recovery likely dumped large quantities of TCE from their site across the street down ICN's dry well after the lab was closed. So far, ICN has spent in excess of $2 million on remedial investigations, engineering costs, and other expenses as a prelude to remediating the groundwater contamination. At this time, our least cost groundwater cleanup alternative will probably run in the area of approximately $3 million more. If the remediation alternative we select does not work, it is possible that our cleanup expenses might be as great as $10 million in addition to what we have already spent. Upon discovering the dry well contamination problem, we called our insurers together for a meeting in Portland. We called them together at that time because we believed that the acts of vandalism by DRI at the dry well contaminated the groundwater and were within the scope of our coverage. Although many of our insurers had excluded pollution from our coverage, their exclusions were qualified in that they still covered pollution if the releases were sudden and accidental. We have attached to tab 5 of the materials we've handed out to you today an abbreviated form of coverage page, which is representative of the coverages in many of our policies. Well, upon convening in Portland, representatives of the insurers met with our engineers, reviewed documents, and were asked to form a committee to advise us on ways to keep costs down while we were fulfilling our responsibilities with the Department of Environmental Quality. No insurer volunteered to participate. Each insurer issued denial letters. We have attached a copy of such a preliminary denial letter at tab 6 of our materials to give you an idea of what one of those looked like. We thereupon filed an action in the Multnomah County Circuit Court against approximately 15 insurers. We have since that time settled all of our claims in principle against those who issued primary coverage. The insurers asserted numerous defenses in the course of that litigation, and we have appended, for your information, at tab 7 of our materials, a copy of the affirmative defenses asserted by one of the companies, which are representative of the affirmative defenses we were required to rebut during the litigation. You will note that Commercial Union, the one that is attached to our materials, asserted 51 affirmative defenses during the course of the lawsuit. These defenses were commonly asserted by the other insurers involved. Many of the 51 affirmative defenses directly pertain, in my view, to the terms of the policy. However, many of those defenses were nothing more than an attempt to avoid coverage where pollution coverage was already present. The methods which the insurance companies chose to avoid coverage did not, in my view, further Oregon's public policy. When it became apparent that we had settled the majority of our claims, we had occasion to compare notes with others from Portland law firms who had similar experiences attempting to obtain coverage from insurance companies for their business clients' environmental remediation obligations. Several of the defenses which were asserted in our case and to which this bill pertains were as follows. First, the insurers argued that the laws of other states should apply, not the state of Oregon. Second, the insurers uniformly refused to defend on the grounds that there was no suit. Third, the insurers claimed that they had inadequate notice of the claims. Fourth, the insurers claimed that by working cooperatively with the DEQ, ICN had made voluntary payments to the DEQ, thereby depriving itself of coverage. Fifth, the insurers argued that ICN had no coverage for the cost of remediating groundwater because ICN had access to the groundwater and therefore had ownership or control such as to make the groundwater their own property. And finally, the insurers asserted other claims designed to avoid coverage where pollution coverage otherwise existed and which this bill addresses. A complete copy of Senate Bill 1205 appears at tab 2 of your materials. Following that, at tab 3, we have prepared a section-by-section detailed analysis for your review as you deliberate on this bill. But without getting into all the minutia, it is important to recognize that this bill does not purport to change policy terms. It does not alter contracts made between insureds and insurers. You may have heard that, but it does not do that. Rather, it provides for rules of construction for application by Oregon courts when the policies themselves are not clear, or where the terms are silent, or where the parties to the insurance contract lack an understanding concerning the meaning of policy terms. If an insurance policy is clear, for instance, that the company has no duty to defend unless an action is filed in the trial court, then this bill will not control the interpretation of suit in such a policy. If an insurance policy makes clear that there is no pollution coverage with respect to groundwater, then the terms of that policy will govern, and this bill will likewise have no application with respect to that issue. It is only where the policy terms are ambiguous, or where they are unstated, or where the court finds that the parties do not have a meeting of the minds, that the provisions of this bill will apply. In particular, Section 4, Subsection 2 provides for the rules of construction. Subsection 2A provides that unless the policy provides otherwise, issues of interpretation or enforcement of the policies with respect to coverage for environmental cleanup costs shall be governed by the laws of the State of Oregon whenever the contaminated property is located in the State of Oregon. The laws of other states may not promote cleanup of contaminated property the way Oregon does. Insofar as the health and safety of Oregonians is paramount, and insofar as the law imposes significant obligations upon property owners to facilitate cleanup, it makes sense that Oregon law should dictate the availability of resources to protect its citizens and assist the business community. This rule substantially aligns Oregon law with Washington law with respect to the area of conflict of laws. Subsection 2B provides that unless the terms of the policy are clear, suit includes voluntary agreements, responses to agency orders. The manner in which the government enforces its environmental laws against persons who are responsible for environmental contamination presents a special situation when it comes to insurance. Property owners can substantially minimize their liability for cleanup if they adopt a proactive approach to the problem. It is common that many cleanups conducted by government are more expensive than cleanups conducted by the property owner. It may therefore be in everyone's best interest to enter into a voluntary agreement with the DEQ. To do so not only reduces the cost to the owner, but may allow for more prompt cleanups because DEQ is not required to commence formal enforcement proceedings. Many insurers refuse to pay for the cost an owner incurs when negotiating with the DEQ under the voluntary cleanup program, or for the cost of investigating the property at the direction of the DEQ, merely because the DEQ has not filed a lawsuit. In the affirmative defenses, the copy of which we've attached to our materials, there is in fact an affirmative defense that there was no suit. The other insurers in our case asserted a similar affirmative defense that they had no duty to defend with respect to voluntary cooperative agreements with the DEQ. The rule in this bill basically provides that unless the policy provides otherwise, entering into a voluntary cleanup agreement with the DEQ is tantamount to a suit. It recognizes Oregon's rule in the McCormick and Baxter case and extends it to voluntary cleanup agreements as opposed to merely responding to agency orders. Subsection 2C relates to voluntary payments. Many insurers attempt to avoid pollution coverage, which is otherwise present, merely because an owner has acted responsibly and has negotiated a voluntary agreement with the DEQ. In these instances, insurers have taken the position that the insured has voluntarily paid for cleanup and consequently refused to cover the cleanup costs. These defenses were asserted in our case. Well, state and federal environmental laws impose strict liability upon all persons responsible for cleaning up. An owner, therefore, almost always has a legally obligated requirement to clean up, and it is in the owner's election, I guess, then, whether to pay less under a voluntary cleanup agreement or substantially more if the DEQ is forced to clean up the property first and then seek reimbursement from the owners. These positions together that are taken by insurers discourage voluntary compliance. They encourage regulatory disobedience. Members of the committee, they are awful public policy. This section adopts decisions of several Oregon trial courts and the Washington Supreme Court. There is currently no Oregon appellate rule that addresses this particular issue. Subsection 2D provides that absent a formal pleading filed in a circuit court, it is sufficient notice for an insurer to provide a summary of the actions taken against it by the DEQ. There is no current appellate rule on this subject. Subsection 2E pertains to delay and prejudice and provides that the lack of notice to insure, unless the policy provides otherwise, is not a defense provided the insurer has not been prejudiced and that the insured's failure to give notice is not unreasonable. I'm going to skip down in my testimony to Section 2G. It concerns exhaustion of primary limits. Many times, insureds purchase in addition to their primary coverage what is called excess coverage, which insures them beyond the primary coverage policy limits. Most excess insurers take the position that in an environmental context, the insured must first exhaust all of the primary carriers who were present during the years in which a release may have occurred before any one of the excess carriers has any liability. This is known as horizontal exhaustion. Senate Bill 1205 makes clear that unless the policy provides otherwise, the rule should be one of vertical exhaustion. In other words, if an insured exhausts the primary limits of his primary policy for a particular year, the excess carrier for that year should then step up to the plate. Subsection 2G adopts Washington case law on this rule, in this area. There is no Oregon rule that currently addresses the situation. Subsection 2H relates to owned property and groundwater. The most difficult and expensive challenges in the environmental context is remediating contamination to groundwater. Insurers have argued that just because an insured has an opportunity to have access to the groundwater, that the insured has such ownership or control over the groundwater as to qualify under the owned property exemptions to the policies. Unless the policy is absolutely clear, this section would basically codify what is currently Oregon existing case law. And finally, subsection 2I relates to allocation among insurers. It provides that if carriers are found to be liable, they should be jointly and severally liable up to their policy limits, of course, and must then allocate responsibility for judgments among themselves as opposed to burdening the insured. Now, most of you, and especially Senator Brown, recall efforts that I made in 1995 tort reform to abolish the doctrine of joint several liability. Senate Bill 601 from the 1995 session, in fact, did that in the typical tort context, substituting, as you recall, the doctrine of reallocation. However, Senate Bill 601 from 1995 expressly exempted liability for environmental claims. Unless and until liability for environmental claims is no longer joint and several, and as long as property owners remain jointly and severally liable for their cleanup responsibilities, the insurance should follow their liability. Now, we have already heard much from the insurance community regarding this bill and the dire consequences they predict will follow its passage. And I would just like to touch upon a number of them prior to concluding my testimony. I have received, members of the committee, a copy of a memo from one such insurance company addressed to an association which will be meeting next month to determine its position on this bill. For that reason, I will not use the name of the insurance company, nor will I use the name of the association, but I will review their claims and our responses. First, this insurer states that it is opposed to the bill because it will make insurance companies, quote, liable for all costs associated with environmental liability claims, regardless of what the insurance contract states, unquote. Well, to rebut that claim, one merely look at page 3, line 36 of the bill, which clearly states, quote, the rules of construction set forth in subsection 2 of this section shall not apply if the application of the rule results in an interpretation contrary to the mutual intent of the parties to the general liability insurance policy. Members of the committee, if the general liability insurance policy is clear as to a particular term, this bill will have no applicability at all. Second, this particular insurer states, quote, if enacted, this bill would force insurance companies to pay for claims which the policy was never intended to cover and for which premiums were never collected. Well, to rebut that claim that the insurers never intended to cover pollution liability, we have appended at tab 8 a copy from the Insurance Council Journal as early as July 1944 containing what was then the new 1944 comprehensive general liability policy utilized uniformly by the CGL carriers nationwide. At the second page of that exhibit, at tab 8, the journal states, quote, the objective has been to afford protection against liability for any hazard, not excluded. The plan reverses the old procedure. Instead of insuring against only hazards enumerated, the insurance is broad enough to embrace all exposures to liability loss except those specifically stated as not covered. The journal further states, quote, summing up, it can be readily seen that except for the limitations established by the standard insuring clauses and exclusions, all hazards of liability loss are covered, whether such hazards are shown to exist or not. The insurance is no longer limited to only those specified hazards against which an insured might ask for protection. Therefore, it is readily apparent that our client and many others in the business community who purchased all risk policies with the expectation that they would provide insurance for just that, all risks, unless the risks are specifically excluded. This was their expectation. Now, the insurers argue, nevertheless, that no one could have anticipated pollution risk, even though all risks other than those excluded are covered. At tab 9, you will find a speech made by Mr. Gilbert Bean, an author of the 1966 revisions to the standard form CGL policy. In the 1966, that standard form used primarily by all liability insurers, used by all primary liability insurers was revised. Mr. Bean, in his speech to the Mutual Insurance Technical Conference Joint Meeting, stated at page 21 of that document at tab 9, quote, but the most widespread new hazard for manufacturers comes from writing the new policy on an occurrence basis. The operations of some risks may create a substantial gradual injury or gradual property damage exposure to which the insurance did not previously apply. Examples are industries which make serious noise, odor, vibration, or dust. There are also risks which use poisons or toxic or radioactive substances whose operations might create severe hazards to other than employees. On the next page, Mr. Bean, the author of the form, goes on to say, quote, perhaps it is in the waste disposal area that the manufacturer's basic premises operations coverage is liberalized most substantially. Smoke, fumes, and other air or stream pollution have caused an endless chain of severe claims for general property damage. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mr. Bean made absolutely clear as early as 1965 that insurers knew that the 1966 CGL revisions contemplated coverage for pollution liability, which would be spread gradually over many policy periods within the scope of their insurance coverage. Finally, this particular insurer in its memo states, quote, the impact of on the average consumer would probably be premium increases of up to 500% or possibly the inability to find coverage. That is quite a claim, a 500% increase in premium as a result of this bill. To rebut that claim, we have also several points. First, almost all of the risks from CGL policies issued in the 60s, 70s, and the 80s are reinsured anyway. We have appended, just by way of example, at tab 12 of your materials, the best insurance report for one such company we've just picked out of the blue, Country Companies. This report is quite common among many insurers. You will note at page 1387 of that exhibit an indication that with respect to reinsurance programs, the largest amount to which Country Companies is now exposed in any one risk is $600,000. The report states casualty excesses of loss reinsurance afford protection against bodily injury or property damage losses exceeding $600,000 up to $6.6 million on an occurrence basis. Therefore, if this particular company is reinsured, is reinsured between $600,000 and $6.6 million on each and every such claim. There is no exposure within $600,000 to $6.6 million for this particular company. All of these companies have reinsurance. Second, we've attached to our material for tab 10, congressional testimony by the RAND Corporation, which found that on average, 88 cents out of every dollar paid out by liability insurers for cleanup-related activities were for what are called transaction costs, not cleaning up. In addition, half of that, 44 cents out of every dollar, were devoted to litigation with policyholders over whether the insurance even applied. Finally, at tab 11, we have attached excerpts from an amicus brief from the American Insurance Corporation, which states, quote, insurers spend conservatively $1 billion a year in so-called coverage litigation, typically in the form of declaratory judgment actions. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the issues covered by Senate Bill 1205 are hotly litigated precisely because they are ill-defined in the policies. It is very possible that if Oregon clarifies its rules in these particular subject areas, insurers will be able to save some of those 44 cents per dollar paid out on environmental coverage litigation because they will no longer be involved in endless squabbles with their customers who believe they deserve coverage for the premium dollars they have paid. Most of the provisions of Senate Bill 1205 either reflect codifications of present Oregon case law or reflect codifications of present Washington case law. Last time we checked, insurance was still available in the state of Washington, and prices in the state of Washington have not gone through the roof. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I thank you for your patience and attention during this presentation. I believe Senate Bill 1205 is a significant bill which will greatly assist in furthering Oregon's policy towards cleaning up its hazardous waste sites and will be a further assistance to business which merely seeks to do the right thing. There are farmers, gas station owners, dry cleaners, and owners of property which in the past were polluted by business activities which were at the time legal. There are also those such as ICN who believe they were the victims of vandalism. All of these concerns face strict liability for cleanup. Some of them were fortunate enough to have pre-1986 CGL policies, which covered pollution if the release was sudden and accidental. Why should these concerns be encouraged to thumb their nose at the regulators and refuse to cooperate for fear of losing their insurance coverage? A DEQ administrative order is just as coercive as a lawsuit. Insurers should not be permitted to avoid otherwise valid claims merely because the insured seeks to do the right thing. We urge the committee to approve Senate Bill 1205 and are available to answer any questions you may have.
John, you cited the McCormick and Baxter case where apparently the court said that a voluntary cleanup agreement
has the same significance as being sued by the DEQ or the EPA. Is that correct? Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the McCormick and Baxter case stated that a response to an administrative order by the DEQ was equally coercive and had the same status as a suit. It did not concern a situation in which a party had entered into a voluntary cleanup agreement. What we are trying to do in this bill is basically codify the rule with respect to responding to administrative orders and also extend it to voluntary cleanup agreements because in both instances the liability is still absolute and the parties know they are on the hook for cleaning up.
Well, that was my question because a voluntary cleanup is not something that's caused by an administrative ruling. As I understand it, it's something that the landowner voluntarily proposes, pays the upfront cost, even pays for the experts that the DEQ requires in order to examine the site and clean it up. So there's not an administrative order requiring the landowner to do something. It is voluntary. Now, but at the same time, if you don't clean it up sooner or later, you're going to have to because they'll sue you or get around it requiring it to be done. But most landowners want to use their property again or develop it or have other purposes and say, I want to clean it up, and then you go through this process and it takes quite a bit of time and effort.
to accomplish, but there is no administrative order that requires it. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the DEQ has adopted administrative rules which pertain to the voluntary cleanup program. The voluntary cleanup program is encouraged by the DEQ, especially in situations where an administrative order is likely to be forthcoming anyway. The reason it is encouraged is because by waiting for the administrative order, the environmental contamination might be exacerbated, might get worse and worse and worse. The McCormick and Baxter case did not have occasion to consider whether a response to a voluntary cleanup agreement would in fact qualify. We believe that if presented with that circumstance, it likely would.
You mentioned joint and several liability, and of course, Senate Bill 601 in 1995 had that apportionment plan. Would that same type of apportionment work here rather than joint and several liability?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the only way, in my view, that the apportionment, the reallocation plan that was present in Senate Bill 601 would work in this context is if the underlying liability was also several, not joint, yet subject to reallocation. Our view is that while liability is strict and while parties, even the person who did not, who is not responsible for the contamination, is still jointly and severally liable with the person who was responsible, that the insurance should follow the liability. There are two ways to address that. I guess one way would be to provide that the insurance follows the liability. The other way would be to make the liability several. That, in this environment, would probably be pretty difficult.
Other questions?
Sure.
Yeah. I just heard they read to the bill. I'm just curious. Just a couple of points on your section 4, page 2, which says, is each in the section sue the lawsuit includes but is not limited to any law, informal judicial proceedings, administrative proceedings, actions taken under Oregon, a federal law, including actions taken, blah, blah, blah. What else is this? I mean, it says, I'm just curious, sue the lawsuit includes but not is not limited to. After you get through the laundry list here, the litany, John, what else is there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, there probably is not much left. This, of course, is something that legislative counsel prefers to do to make sure that they have captured every possibility. But basically, we are looking, by saying not limited to, I guess, should DEQ or the EPA adopt some other form of voluntary agreement and maybe call it something different in the future, okay, then the catch-all would cover it.
Down to lines 19-20, Oregon law shall be applied in all cases where the contaminated property to which the action relates is located within the state of Oregon. Of course, that wouldn't apply to the Indian reservations, and it wouldn't apply, would it apply to federal land? I mean, but they always say how much the federal government owns of Oregon. What about federal land?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, I'm not sure what the answer to that question is. I can get back to you on that, though.
That's fine. The last one I found really interesting because it's like somebody's anticipating the worst. The last section, section 7, page 3, it says, if this act is held unconstitutional or void or otherwise devoid of any force or effect, the remaining parts shall remain in force and remaining parts within any section containing parts held unconstitutional, otherwise devoid of any force or effect, shall survive if the section is capable of being executed in accordance with the legislative intent. That's interesting language. I does that mean if the Supreme says it's unconstitutional, it's still constitutional? If we can get a clause or phrase, I have to admit, I mean, that's true to me. I don't quite, you know, what is that about, John?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, this is a sort of an expansion of the normal severability clause, which is assumed in all legislation you pass anyway. There is a statute on the books that said it is assumed that unless the legislative intent indicates otherwise, where a court finds that one provision of a statute is unconstitutional but others aren't, they're to sever them. We decided to put this in because we have so many sections and subsections. We wanted to make sure that if a subsection of a section was found to be deficient, that the whole section wouldn't come out as opposed to just that particular subsection. So it was overkill, and it's just being careful. But there is a presumption that any legislative enactment you pass is severable.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Brown.
I have a question on page 3 of the bill, lines 37 and 38, and the language reads, the rule results in an interpretation contrary to the mutual intent of the parties. My concern about that language is it seems pretty squishy to me. Aren't you allowing the court here to sort of go behind the actual statutory or the language of the policy itself and look at what the parties intended as opposed to what the contract or the policy says? And is that your intent?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, actually, we meant this to protect the insurers more than anyone else. Obviously, if the insurance policy is clear, if, for instance, the insurance policy provided that for this excess policy, it is not effective until the insured has exhausted all primary policies, and if that was clearly written into the insurance policy, then, of course, because it was clearly written, it would reflect the intent of the parties. We thought we'd go a little bit beyond that, too, because sometimes there are ambiguities, but yet they can be explained by the party's intention at the time they entered into the contract. So we thought we would err on the side of the insurers, actually, to give them just even a little bit more leeway. We could have just said these rules of construction will apply unless the policy is crystal clear. We didn't say that. If the policy is crystal clear, that is the intent of the parties. If it isn't crystal clear, then the court can delve into an exercise to determine what their intent was. Only if the court finds that the parties did not have an intention one way or the other do these rules of construction apply.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Senator Brown.
That would go both ways, though, wouldn't it? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown is correct.
Thanks.
Other questions? Yes. Thank you, Senator. Mm-hmm.
Got a simple question compared to what we just got. On page 2 of your testimony, John, you stated that ICN didn't use TCE in any of the frigging or any of the frigging. Can you give us an idea of the quantity that
they
used found in the driveway?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Q-Tub, TCE is used to clean small electric parts. It's a solvent, and it's a volatile. It evaporates very quickly. It was used by UML personnel on Q-tip swabs to clean small electronic motor parts. There was one occasion that was identified in depositions in which some TCE was sprayed into a generator. The generator ran, spewed the TCE out onto the floor. Most of the TCE evaporated before it got anywhere close to one of the outputs that we believe flowed into the dry well. But at most, there would have been several pints to maybe a gallon. Our folks have suggested that what we have present are hundreds and hundreds of gallons of TCE. They are in the form of what are called DNAPLs. They're dense, non-aqueous phase liquids, and they just clump up and they sink to the bottom of the aquifer. It is a massive, massive problem. The breakdown products are VCE and vinyl chloride, and we had no use for those at all, period. But those were the types of uses. But there was no way in our view that we could have generated that much.
And then one other question. You also mentioned in your testimony, you made mention of Washington law on several occasions, but near the end of your testimony on page 13, you said that the last time you checked insurance was still available in the state of Washington.
Right. Chairman, Senator Q-Tub, we have made inquiries of insurance rating bureaus in the state of Washington. What we have gotten back has not been definitive whatsoever. It is very difficult for the raters to determine where premiums are. We have heard, however, that the competition for insurance is quite brisk in the state of Washington, and that that competition may, in fact, have kept premium dollars down. We don't know. We still have inquiries out, and maybe the insurers who are here today will be able to answer that question and hopefully put to rest this claim that premiums go up 500%.
Yes. Yeah, one last thing. I find this bill, the language of this bill, somewhat fascinating because, like, the legislative assembly finds that there are many insurance coverage disputes involving Oregon insurers who face potential liability for their ownership of or roles at polluted sites in the state. That's almost law review language versus statutory language, if you know what I mean. And I mean, just an observation that just sort of fascinates me when I was reading it. It's more like a law review article as I read through some of this versus statutory language. And that's, you don't have to comment, but I maybe you don't agree with me, but, and I'm not trying to put anybody on the spot, but I just, somehow it doesn't strike me as some of the language is statutory versus law review type language, if you know what I mean, John.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, we faced a little bit of concern from legislative counsel with that section. Some felt that it was a bit literary. We decided to put it in, though, in light of the severability clause because we wanted to give the court a legislative intent present in the statute to guide it when it decided whether or not certain parts that it reviewed could work in conjunction with other parts. That was merely the reason for drafting that. Certainly, that's within your province, though, to change those provisions if you deem it appropriate.
So whatever we say won't be part of the intent, all go to the law. I mean, I don't get into it. I just say the intent will go beyond just what the bill is if it passes, right? I mean, there's all kinds of things going to legislative intent, isn't that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, I have always felt that, but recently Oregon courts have been very strict about, first of all, discerning legislative intent from the context of the statute itself and from the four corners.
Okay.
And so this is just in reaction to that and sort of a safeguard.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Brinkle.
On page 8 of your testimony, you talk about the exhaustion of primary limits, and you want to switch from horizontal exhaustion to vertical exhaustion. And I think I understand what those mean, but I'm wondering why that is part of this bill. What does that have to do with the problem that you're trying to solve?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, first of all, there is no clear law in Oregon as to whether there should be horizontal or vertical exhaustion. In our case, the court found that California law would apply merely because the policies were purchased in the state of California. We argued that Oregon's interest in the cleanup of its contaminated sites were at least of equal dignity with California's interest in the interpretation and enforcement of its contracts. Nevertheless, the court ruled that the law had not been developed to that point, and that California law would apply, and in California the law is horizontal exhaustion. What that means is that every single policy down the line, if it's over a number of years, has to first be tapped before the excess carrier steps up to the plate. In our case, what that meant was we had to dismiss all of the excess carriers until we had fully resolved our litigation vis-a-vis the primary carriers. And, you know, if you're facing significant cleanup expenses, it's just one more hurdle in the way to effectuating a cleanup.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justin. Next, we'll hear from the panel of the opponents, John Powell, Tom Gordon, and Jack Monroe.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jack Monroe, speaking this evening on behalf of the American Insurance Association. I'm joined tonight by one state familiar to John Howell, who represents State Farm and Notre State Insurance Company.
Who's going to raise my hand?
And the other being
a stranger.
Yes, a state not familiar to you. And he's Tom Gordon, an attorney with the firm of Gordon Holster in Portland. Tom has practiced law for 25 years or so, the last 15 plus years almost exclusively in the environmental area. And John and I will get out of the way very quickly here to allow Tom to deal with as many issues as can be dealt with in the brief period of time that we have here. Just a couple of comments, though, almost background comments, if you will. These are almost always very complex situations, and there are probably only a couple of elements that are common to these situations. One, there's been some kind of environmental degradation of some sort at a particular site, although I think I appreciated Senator Courtney's question about the language and the artful wording in this bill, and I think it deserves a careful reading, because some of the language not heretofore discussed raises other issues. If you look at the definitions, for example, environmental claims actually encompass personal injury claims that aren't associated necessarily with a particular site. If you look at the language, we obviously talked about official or semi-official communications with the EPA or the DEQ official bodies, but clearly the language here also talks about some kind of communication from another third party, whatever that might be. And so obviously the bill deserves your careful consideration. But clearly, again, one element in most of these cases, some sort of environmental contamination at a particular site. The other issue is that in many cases, this contamination occurred over a very long period of time, in some cases decades. Now, beyond that, all of the other facts might well be highly variable. There might have been one owner. There might have been, most likely, there were multiple owners. The owner might have been responsible for causal events. Or it might have been another party. The act might have been normal commercial activity at the time, or it might have been criminal activity, as it was in the case that Mr. DiLorenzo cited. There might be different sources of contamination that are at issue, or multiple sources. And maybe most significantly to those of us speaking for the industry, obviously in many of these cases, in most of these cases, in fact, there will have been multiple insurance policies. And the longer the period of time that we're involved with, the greater the number of the policies and the greater variety of those policies. And in fact, of course, there's no guarantee that the party was insured throughout that period of time. So sorting out, obviously, one insurer, for example, might not have had any knowledge of the existence of the other or the terms of the detail. The bottom line is that these are always complicated factual situations. It would be nice to be able to resolve them quickly and painlessly. Unfortunately, figuring out whether and what kind of contamination exists, when it occurred, how it can best be handled and sorted out, who bears responsibility, and all of those other issues can't be done quickly and painlessly. And an attempt to find a simple solution to a complex problem like that is likely to shift the pain and maybe interject delay rather than speeding up the process. But with that, I think we'd like to turn it over to Tom Gordon, who will take you through the measure in greater detail.
Good evening. As Mr. Monroe mentioned, these fact situations, how pollution occurs, are unique to the individual cases. There are as many examples that I could give you as Mr. DiLorenzo gave you on the ICN case. Interestingly, though, he mentioned that they didn't use TCE in appreciable quantities. TCE is highly toxic, and it is regulated in terms of drinking water standards down to the level of 5 parts per billion. He mentioned that only potentially a few quarts were used by their business, or spilled, as I recall his testimony, that would be sufficient to contaminate the entire aquifer out there in the Columbia River. So, as I say, when the place where these have been sorted through in their complexity, case by case by case, has been in the trial courts of the state of Oregon for good reason. These are not generic cases. You cannot just put them up on the board and come up with a hard and fast rule that creates equity across the board. Mostly for that reason, because of the longevity, the long tail, the difficulty in sorting through the facts of these cases, they are uniquely suited to the judicial system when and if there is a dispute. For that reason, and that reason alone would be sufficient, that to pass a statute that has this sweeping effect and creates all policies or treats them all to be generic, we believe would be just simply bad public policy. It is not rules of construction we are talking about here. This rewrites the policy. This defines the language going forward. It impairs the contracts which have long since been honored and put away in the drawer because they have expired. It vastly expands the insurer's responsibility in an area for which they have received no premium and for which they undertook no risk. Thirdly, it creates what I call market share liability. The mere fact that you sold liability insurance in this state, no matter what it looked like, no matter what the language was, no matter what the agreements were, you would have your market share of liability. If you sold 1% of the insurance in this state, you would end up with 1% of the problem, because it's all being passed through to the carriers. What makes it more draconian is when you combine it with the joint and several liability. Because if you only wrote 1% of the insurance in this state, but your policyholders were the ones that you were dealing with, because of the joint and several obligations here, you would end up with 100% of their liability. You take those two together, and you are passing through a huge dollar amount. In it's just basically social risk shifting on these, based on these older contracts. We believe that this language is unconstitutional, that it would impair those contracts that have already been, as I say, put on the shelf, honored, and expired. It goes back and rewrites them. It redefines the terms. Secondly, it steps on the toes of the judiciary, which have done a lot in terms of what I would call real rules of construction. Where there are doubts or where there are issues, the Oregon Supreme Court, in a case called Hoffman, has given us rules for the road, and they simply are that. It tells you how to interpret the contract. It doesn't tell you what they mean. This tells you what it means. We think that it would violate the separation of powers provisions of the Constitution as well. So on its face, this statute has all kinds of problems that we see right up front. I can tell you that this is not Washington. There is no law in Washington similar to this. There is no statute. There is no statute that I'm familiar with around the country like this. This would be the first time that anybody has gone to this length to rewrite old contracts. So the specifics. What I did was, in order to make it easier, realizing that this was a late in the evening session, and that nobody wanted to plow through in great detail the language, I did it in two parts. One is there's a more detailed summary, which I suggest you can read at your leisure. It just gives you a little more detail about what's going on. What I was going to go through with you tonight is what I call the impact of the proposed changes, which is just the bullet points, and it has three columns, the proposed change, the current law, and the impact or the result. So specifics. What's interesting is this doesn't apply, the statute doesn't apply to just those old contracts that he was referring to. There's no restriction in the statute. It applies to contracts that are issued today on the face of the bill. I see nothing in there that restricts it in terms of any time, nor does it restrict it in terms of scope. Liability policies are not all the same. You can have any variety of liability policies, one that was, as they call it, manuscripted, which means two parties sit down and actually negotiate it, all the way to foreign policies, which is mostly what you see in this state. So in between that, you could have policies special to that kind of business. You could have a marine policy, you could have an industrial policy, you could have an aviation policy, you could have whatever kind of policy you need for that particular industry or book of business. This bill doesn't differentiate between any of those. It basically, as I said, creates market share. If you wrote something that says insurance and has that at the top of the page, and it's defined as liability insurance in this state, this bill will impact it. So we see that it has no time limit and it has no scope. Now, with respect to the actual provisions, Mr. DiLorenzo mentioned that Oregon law would apply to all sites within the state. And he couches that in terms of that would be a good public policy for this state because it would protect policyholders in this state. Well, policies, insurance policies, don't normally have a choice of law provision in them for good reason. It protects both parties. Many, many policyholders are not residents of the state of Oregon. They are multinational businesses, or at least national businesses. They may have many plants throughout the country or throughout the world. They go out and they buy one insurance policy, and they buy it in California, because that's where their main headquarters is. They may buy it in New York. They want that policy to be interpreted in a single voice just as much as the insurance company does. So if they bought that policy in New York and they do business in 50 states, they don't want it to be subjected to 50 different interpretations from legislators or judges or anybody else. That's why there is a whole body of law which tells you how to, as they say, resolve the conflicts and come to the choice of law. It's called the restatement. It works fine. In the McCormick and Baxter case that was referred to, it actually worked to apply Oregon law because that's where the policyholder resided and the site was in the state of Oregon. So this is a two-sided coin, the idea of choice of law. And I think in Mr. DiLorenzo's case, perhaps he didn't like the result because it was California and it wasn't favorable on a particular issue. But I can tell you there are a lot of policyholders who would like California law or Illinois law or New York law. And again, it just depends on where the contract was entered into and where the risks are located. Secondly, in defining suits under 4.2b, they made again reference to the McCormick and Baxter case and the issues of voluntary payments or requests. The facts of that case, I think, are instructive. And I'll just give you a brief blurb. This is directly from the opinion. In 1983, McCormick and Baxter notified the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality that there was soil and groundwater contamination at its Portland site. So this is one of those cases where they went and voluntarily identified themselves. DEQ and McCormick and Baxter met on a regular basis from 1983 until 1987. And then they executed the consent decree. So this was, in fact, a problem where they negotiated it out, and they voluntarily stepped forward. One of the carriers in that case, Hartford, made the contention that there was no duty to defend because there wasn't any, quote, suit. It was in a lawsuit. What the Oregon Court of Appeals said was, under the statutes governing cleanup of environmental damage, McCormick and Baxter was going to have to pay. Your point, I think, Mr. Chairman. The fact that they chose to try to gain a more favorable resolution by cooperation, that's the court's word, instead of litigation, does not mean that the agency was not making a claim that McCormick and Baxter was responsible for the damages. They therefore found it was a suit. Oregon law has already gone a long ways down this road, and I don't think that this language is necessary to be the foundation of the passing of any new bill. What's interesting in that language, however, is that they use the word damages. That plays into the next subsection, which is 4.2c, where they talk about cleanup costs. And there's a fundamental distinction here that needs to be talked about just briefly. Policies have two aspects to them. There's one aspect they call a duty to defend, and there's a second one called a duty to indemnify. The reason those are significant is, under the old rules where you had suits, that's really all you ever had was lawsuits before the days of government enforcement came along. So the sheriff would come and he would serve you with the summons, and with the summons would be a complaint. Now within the complaint, we call that the four corners of the complaint. The rules were, and always have been, that you take that complaint, you compare it to the insurance policy, and if there's arguably coverage that can't be sorted out without a lot of facts, you defend it. That defense is beyond the limits of the policy. It has no limitation to it. If you get liability because you caused the accident or whatever, then you pay the indemnity. Well, a lot of what we're talking about here today in terms of these voluntary payments and the suit issue is beyond the limits. It is the defense obligation that they're really talking about. Those dollars are astronomical, and they won't be impacted the least by reinsurance. Reinsurance, if it pays anything, pays an indemnity dollar. So, when you take together 42C and 42B, these voluntary payments can shift a huge sum of money for which no premium was accepted and certainly no risk was undertaken, and which will not be, in any definition, reinsured. It also provides an opportunity, since if we're talking about quote-unquote voluntary payments, for insureds who may not be the most honest or who may be under financial stress or may not be competitive at the moment because their competitors have passed them by, to in effect upgrade their facilities by voluntarily agreeing to do a whole bunch of things, which would include new roofs, new gutters, blacktopping, upgrading equipment, doing piping, drains, and systems, and putting in new equipment, all of which, just coincidentally, might also make them far more competitive. That is not quote-unquote damages, which is what was referred to in the McCormick and Baxter case. And the control on all of this, as the court recognized, which was so vital to the insurance industry, was that damages concept. Without it, you're giving the policyholders a blank check. And that's what the provisions of this statute do when you take together the suit provisions and the voluntary cleanup provisions. It's also what happens when you allow a policyholder to do nothing more than write their own version of the facts and send in that summary, and that constitutes all they have to do. No more due diligence, no more right to investigate, no right to control that defense. That constitutes notice, and the policyholder sends it in with their by registered mail, and that's the end. And all of these costs then get driven through this duty to defend. The other next provision deals with the untimely notice. Again, the Oregon courts, Car Chevrolet is a case that I was involved in not long ago, where they set out, again, under the particular facts of that case, the rules that would be applied to prove whether a notice was late and whether a policyholder was untimely in the sense that it was unreasonable and whether there was prejudice. This zeroes in on only one of those options. So this, in effect, rewrites the term of that policy. This is not a rule of construction. It simply dictates how it's going to come out. The defense costs include pre- and post-tender. That's 42F. This is one of the real biggies, and I think, Senator Courtney, you were talking about what's left. Not much. When you talk about pre- and post-tender costs and all the remedial investigation, all the feasibility, and all the selection costs being outside of limits as defense costs, there isn't much left. And I can tell you I've seen cases, not in this state yet, but in other states where policyholders, pretty slick, will go out and do what they refer to as pilot projects, which is to say, in an effort to, quote-unquote, mitigate their damages or test to see whether remedy selection would be appropriate, they literally clean the place up, bit by bit, pilot by pilot, so at the end, there is no indemnity left. Every dollar has been paid through defense costs, and that's the way it works. So this is, again, a blank check to those who would be less than honest. And it isn't necessary because the courts, as they said in McCormick and Baxter, already have this damages concept well in hand. Finally, the appropriation of groundwater I don't think is a significant issue, and in the interest of time, just let me mention what I think is perhaps the most draconian of the measures or the subparts is 42I, the joint and several liability. Remember, as I mentioned, we're not talking about market share, and we're talking about joint and several liability. That's quite a tandem. When you drive most of the costs outside of your limits, and if you're the only insurance company who happened to write a policy on that, you get stuck for the entire bill. And that's happened. I had a case in Portland where the policyholder got convicted of criminal environmental acts for putting chromium into the groundwater. They had the foresight to buy one insurance policy. They never bought one before, and they never bought one after. Under this bill, there would be joint and several liability to that carrier. The policyholder would pay nothing under their definition, and that insurance company would have ended up paying the whole thing. So as I say, each of these cases is complex. Each one of them is individual, and there is no easy solution that can be a magic wand to oversimplify this, as I think the proponents have suggested. Yeah, let me mention just briefly the exhaustion issue. I think Senator Burdick, you raised that. Excess insurance is written on a totally different basis than primary. It is far, far cheaper. And the reason it's far, far cheaper is because there's no duty to defend built in. The duty to defend only accrues when the underlying policy is truly exhausted, and that's how they keep the premiums down. If you artificially exhaust these policies by saying any settlement for less than policy limits, which an insured agrees to take, then drags in the excess carrier, we're not talking about the indemnity side here again. We're talking about the defense side. That would put untold dollars shifted to the excess carriers for which they never got a premium and never envisioned a premium, and the policyholder never envisioned that duty. So, again, the exhaustion issue is big in the sense of the defense. So that is a brief run through the bill and to how it drastically turns a lot of settled law around this country on its head. We think it is unnecessary. It would clearly be the first time in the country anybody's attempted to do this. And certainly if it passes in its current form, would raise serious, serious questions about impairment of contract under the Constitution and separation of powers. Finally, I should also mention the issue that he talked about, mutual intent and clarity, because that seems to be an important one. Keep in mind, insurance policies are not, for the most part, mutually negotiated. They are not like you and me sitting down to decide if I'm going to sell my house and how we're going to do it and what the terms are. Insurance is a regulated industry. In order to sell insurance in this state, you have to get your forms pre-approved by the state insurance commissioner. It's called a file and approval state, as with most others. So in effect, these are unilateral policies by definition. So the insurance commissioner acts in the stead of the consumer and works out the details with the insurance companies and then approves them for use within the state. There is no mutual intent, and there never will be any mutual intent by the nature of the beast. So by putting the burden of proof upon the carrier to come forward and say that these things are ambiguous unless you can show the mutual intent, by definition, cannot happen. The insurer will lose every time, by definition. So mutual intent is a huge red herring. And with that, I think maybe we've used our time. I'll turn it over to John real briefly.
Chairman, I'm going to concede most of my time to Mr. Peruca, who has made time available. There are a couple things I want to just introduce quickly. And for the record, my name is John Powell, representing North Pacific, TGU, North Pacific Insurance Company, and State Farm Insurance Company. And also, for the record, it should be clear that I like John DiLorenzo. Somebody said, somebody said I didn't. And I told him I hate the bill. I hate his bill. It's a terrible bill, but I like him. So that's clear on the record. That's very clear, and it was emphasized and underlined several times. So if there was any misunderstanding between myself or anybody else, I'm at least willing to stand here and look at everybody and say, if I said that, I must have been dreaming, because I didn't mean it, for sure.
I guess to amend the bill.
I think there should be another section. Mr. Chairman, I will enter to your staff, and I didn't make a copy for everybody, a letter from Mr. Larry Becker, the president of TGU North Pacific. North Pacific is a domestic company that's been in Oregon for years and years and years, and it's written tons of general liability insurance in the state from day one. So they would be, along with other insurers, very heavily impacted, as this letter will note. What I've handed to you is perhaps some answer to one of the puzzling questions earlier that Senator Courtney asked, and that was, where did some of this language come from? One document that I handed you from the Washington Insurance Commissioner is the rules that they adopted a few years ago on retention and loss policy regulation in, concerning pollution liability. And if you look at the first highlighted section, retention of policy forms beginning July 1, 1996, clearly these rules were prospective. They had nothing to do about going back in time. It's policies that were issued after. But the language, if you flip the page, to the purpose section at the top of page 2, where it says purpose, it says there are many insurance coverage disputes involving Washington insureds who face potential liability for their roles at polluted sites in this state. That is a direct quote from section 3, I believe, of the bill. So a lot of the language perhaps came out of these rules.
However, I want you to understand very clearly that these rules are not in the same league as this bill. In fact, they don't even get on the first rung. These rules deal with lost policy reconstruction. And in fact, the highlighted section on page 2 in the lower right-hand corner that I highlighted for you, the following procedures are minimum standards for the facilitation of reconstructing a lost policy and determining its terms. These procedures do not create a presumption of coverage for the loss once the contract is reconstructed. Indeed, these rules were done on a regulatory basis in the state of Washington. The other letter piece of paper that I've handed you is from a Best publication, a bureau that rates insurers on a financial basis. And it's been said by the proponents of this bill that, yeah, there's going to be some hits out there, but you don't have to worry. Big things like hurricanes happen, tornadoes happen. These insurance companies, they're just blips on their little radar screen. Well, if you look at the highlighted sections, this article makes clear that it's a wonder more insurance companies have not become insolvent over time. But as it says in the, and I'm quoting it from page 7, the industry's high watermark for insolvencies occurred in 1992, and 14 property casualty insurers became insolvent as a result of Hurricanes Andrew and Nikki. Interestingly, several large insurers could have become insolvent had it not been for financial flexibility provided by capital infusions from rich parents, e.g. State Farm Fire and Casualty, Prudential Property and Casualty, or the issuance of stock to a strategic buyer at depressed prices in the case of 20th Century. Indeed, basically all of the reserves of State Farm were eaten up in one storm. And if it had not been for about a $3 billion loan from their auto company, that property company would have been insolvent. So these things do matter, and that's why the letter from the president of North Pacific will be entered in the record for your review. And finally, Mr. Chairman, in addition to the comments made on mutual intent, I don't have to belabor that point any farther, if you would look on page 3 of the bill at the prejudice section, the wording of that section is quite revealing. When it says that it precedes it by saying prejudice won't occur unless this happens and unless this happens, and then it says even if it has happened, in the event that actual prejudice has occurred, if reasonable under the circumstances for the insured not to give notice at an earlier date. So even if prejudice did occur, if it was reasonable for them not to give notice on an earlier date, it's not. For the purpose of this subsection, actual prejudice shall exist only where, because of the delay in notification, the insurer is unable to determine the source and timing of the release of the contaminants at issue. Well, there wouldn't be a suit if at least the claimant didn't think they knew when that had happened. Again, it's written to guarantee that when a claim comes forward, almost always the insurer would not have a claim of prejudice.
I have a question for Tom.
Sure.
Has Oregon ruled on horizontal versus vertical exhaustion?
No, not at the appellate court level. There is a fair body of law around the country which undoubtedly would be looked to by the Oregon courts, and has been.
It's strange that hasn't made it up to the appellate court level.
There actually are a disproportionate number right now of insurance issues before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court this year took, and I don't know if that's one of them, but the Supreme Court had took a historically low number of cases on review this year and a disproportionately high number of insurance cases. So they are active in this area.
How many states are horizontal and how many states are vertical on that?
I'm not sure I can answer that specifically. I think you'll find in my more detailed review what the general trends are. I didn't go out and actually take a head count, but I would guess the majority of cases or states right now are probably horizontal by a slight margin.
I'd be curious to see how many state legislatures have decided that issue versus the courts do, as far as
none. To my knowledge, none.
The issue on recovering costs of investigation and preparatory cleanup activity, is there any Oregon law on that currently?
Well, there is at the trial court level, but not at the appellate court level. Yes.
That's similar to exhaustion and haven't
yes.
made it up there yet.
Right.
Other questions of this panel? Yes.
I just wanted to see what your comment was, if any, on the RAND Corporation study.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
It was referred to that found
yeah.
an average of 88 cents out of every dollar was used for transaction costs, not in indemnity costs.
Right. Those dollars would not be reinsured. They would not be reinsured through any other policy. They would be truly transaction dollars. What that really is saying is that 88 cents out of every dollar is now already going to a policyholder to defend itself, towards going.
So that's beyond anything that came
yeah. out of... Well, take that back. When that study was published, as I recall, and I haven't read it for a while, but when that study was published, there was a lot more coverage litigation than there is now. And quite frankly, coverage litigation is rapidly on the decline because most of these issues have been resolved, and now it's just applying the facts. But as I recall, that was roughly split between 40 cents or 40-some cents to defend the policies and another 40-some cents to actually defend the policy holders. So it was about 50-50, as I recall.
Right. It said 44 cents out of each dollar was devoted to litigation with policyholders.
Right.
Over whether the insurance applied. You right. say that's gone down?
Yes. I mean, in Oregon right now, to my knowledge, there are probably fewer than 10 cases involving environmental coverage disputes. I could be off by one or two, but, you know, I've been in a lot of them, and there aren't that many.
Why would they have gone down?
Well, because a lot of these issues have been resolved. The courts have already given direction as to what the law is.
Yeah.
Could it be that they just give up and they don't want to spend the money?
No, actually, the claim volume has remained fairly steady. The insurance industry would tell you that the claims continue to come in, but the litigation has gone down. They're being negotiated, resolved, by virtue of the clarifying cases in the judicial system. And you'll hear anecdotal stories to the contrary. I mean, I'm sure you'll hear some more tonight. But for every one of those, there are many that were never litigated.
Okay.
I see some of my old friends in the back here.
Senator Brown.
I guess, for me, the sort of big issue is you say that these issues have been resolved by courts throughout the nation as opposed to legislatures setting policy. And I guess we lots of times meddle in court cases, and I think 1205 from last session would have done exactly that. So help me sort of analyze why we shouldn't be setting policy on this issue. I know it's several issues, and I know you don't like the policy, but
no.
In terms of why shouldn't we set the policies?
And that's a fair question going forward. So if you wanted to say anybody that wants to write an insurance contract in this state going forward, you should have these provisions and they should mean this, that would be fair. What this bill is about is going back in time and saying all these policies that have long since lapsed will now be interpreted in this fashion. And we're not talking about rules of construction. We're talking about this is what the words will mean in policies that were long since lapsed.
Mr. Chair, isn't it true that some of these older policies are still being litigated in the courts today?
Correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Any questions to this panel? Thank you. What I'm going to do now, looking at the time that's expanded, I'm going to call panels of people up, and I'm going to alternate between proponents and opponents, and then I'll go to neutral. So let's have Terry Witt and Tom Zelenka and Jane Bond from Forsyth. And we have a fourth chair, so we'll also invite Bruce Bosch to come forward, please.
Especially since I think it's coming back.
Terry, why don't you begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman Bryant, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. On April 16, 1999, the Board of Directors of OFS voted unanimously to take a position in support of Senate Bill 1205. I am testifying here on behalf of OFS. The majority of OFS members are farmers, foresters, commercial applicators, and agrochemical dealers or distributors, all of whom store, transfer, mix, or use pesticides, fertilizers, and soil amendments. These materials are nearly all considered hazardous by definition and require special cleanup procedures if more than the reportable quantity of material were spilled in the environment. In addition to agrochemicals, most all of these sites contain storage of gasoline, diesel, or aviation fuel. Cleanup to DEQ or US EPA standards for even a moderately sized chemical spill or site contamination can be extremely costly, far beyond the financial means of most farmers and small businesses. Knowing this, many purchased insurance thinking they were protecting themselves from bankruptcy should an unplanned incident occur or an unknown past contamination be detected on their property. Today, much of our farmland is no longer passed down through a family from generation to generation to generation. Without this continuous chain of ownership, it is often impossible to ensure what activities may have occurred in the past. In the agrochemical business world, many company acquisitions and mergers are now very common occurrences, with some facilities changing ownership several times in a decade. Bulk fertilizer storage and loading facilities typically handle millions of pounds of materials in a year. Many of these businesses also took out all-risk policies, believing that its coverage was just what the name said, all risks. Unfortunately, most will not learn of clever loopholes that avoid coverage until they need to use that policy. While Senate Bill 1205 will not insert pollution coverage into past policies where it was not already present, it will clarify when an insured is or is not covered and for what costs associated with identified contamination cases. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the most significant clarification is establishing that the insurer has a duty to defend and cannot refuse coverage merely because the insured, at the request or direction of an empowered agency, incurs fees or costs while undertaking a voluntary cleanup action or consent decree. Denying coverage unless and until a lawsuit is filed makes no sense environmentally, economically, or morally. It forces landowners and businesses to an adversarial position with regulatory agencies. It delays cleanup, thereby increasing contamination. It increases the ultimate cost of cleanup activities, penalties, and legal costs, and damages the public image of the company and the agencies involved. Insurance companies will undoubtedly claim this bill will make premiums skyrocket or force them to drop pollution coverage altogether. I believe a good case can be made that this bill would actually save them dollars. In either case, what good does this type of insurance do if your policy has more hidden holes than a brick of Swiss cheese? OFS supports this measure and asks for your favorable consideration and passage. Thank you.
Testimony from the entire panel before we open it up for questions. Jane, why don't you bring it?
My name is Jane Bond, and I'm president and CEO of Permapost Products Company, a wood treating and manufacturing firm in Hillsboro, Oregon. Permapost was founded in 1957 by my parents and is now operated by my brother and myself. We employ 25 employees from the Hillsboro area. The average length of employment is 18 years, and the average age of my employees is 45 years. As a wood treater, we pressure treat lumber, plywood, and posts with oil and water-based preservatives to inhibit fungus and insect infestation, thus allowing a longer service life to a renewable resource. We manufacture products for parks and recreation, such as picnic tables and shelters, federal, state, and local highway and pedestrian systems, as in bridges, national forest systems, Forest Service bridges, and trailhead signs. We are relatively small in comparison to other wood treating plants at approximately $5 million in annual sales. I am here this evening to comment on Senate Bill 1205 and its effects on small businesses, particularly companies like mine. First, I would like to give you a brief history on Permapost's cleanup efforts and our experience in dealing with our insurance carriers regarding this cleanup. I will report to you the obstacles Permapost faces in trying to receive policy coverages. During the 1960s and early 70s, Permapost's treating activity consisted mostly of two chemicals, pentachlorophenol, which we call PENA, and copper chromated arsenate, CCA. The normal and accepted operating practice at that time resulted in contamination of part of our site and underlying groundwater. In the late 70s and early 80s, Oregon's DEQ and the US EPA determined that Permapost use of surface impoundments for process control water should be reviewed and directed Permapost to initiate an extensive investigation and subsequent cleanup of contaminated soils and the groundwater. It became clear as to the source of pollution and the type of contaminants which were involved. My father, William Bond, discussed coverage with his insurance agent, broker, who told him there was no coverage for pollution. He believed his agent. Thus, all consulting costs for the site investigation, pollution remediation design, and remediation remedies were borne by Permapost at a cost of $2.9 million. All of our company's profits and more were directed to the costly investigation and cleanup, crippling the company and its operations and draining all of our resources. No monies were available for equipment upgrades. In fact, fixed assets had to be sold and salaries were cut. In addition, the speed at which the cleanup activity could progress was limited to the amount of money the corporation could generate either in profits or money that we could borrow. In the early 1990s, Oregon's court expressly recognized insurance coverage responsibility in the McCormick and Baxter case, another wood treating firm. We recognize this to be a similar circumstances as our cleanup. We revisited our insurance carriers regarding coverage under the policies which Permapost had purchased. The response from the carriers to date has been for them to request mountains of documentation. After we've responded to their request, their answer is that they are not going to pay. Bill 1205 is critical to small business. Anyone who tells you that this bill only helps big business is grossly mistaken. My business, like many in Oregon, has paid insurance premiums. We have now asked for coverage on a claim. The insurance companies have closed their door on us, calculating, and usually correctly so, that we small businesses do not have resources to fight a long and expensive battle. Our interest in Senate Bill 1205 is twofold. Permapost has already spent $2.9 million in cleanup investigation and remediation solely out of our own operations. We are anticipating the future burden of ongoing cleanup activity, as indicated by Oregon DEQ, for the next 30 years at an approximate cost of $2.5 million. The need for the insurance carriers to take responsibility and pay their policy coverage for money spent on cleanup is critical to the continuation of our business. Senate Bill 1205 clarifies the responsibility of the carriers to provide coverage. Senate Bill 1205 does not let the insurance carriers hide behind the defense of late notice. My father was told by his agent that our coverage did not include pollution when it actually did. After the McCormick and Baxter decision renewed our interest in pursuing the coverage, did the issue of delayed notice arise. However, the source of pollution could only be the surface impoundment, and the contaminants could only come from permapost treating activity. There are no other wood treaters in the whole store area. Delayed notice by insurers, the insured should not be a defense for carriers if the businesses were unaware or misled that the coverage existed, and if the delay does not prejudice the insurer. I thank you for the opportunity to speak for you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tom Delanco with the Schnitzer Group. I submitted a detailed statement. Let me just, what I'd like to do is perhaps spend just a few minutes giving you a couple specific examples of how, from our side, the system works. And I'll use one of our recent cleanup activities in downtown Portland as a specific example, and then highlight for you a couple of reasons why I think the legislation in front of you is something worth passage. You heard about, people might give you anecdotes about the problems in the system. In my case, I've got 10 to 12 years worth of anecdotes, and I've got to tell you, in all that time with all the tenders, we have yet to have, I don't think we've got one time when we've tendered an environmental claim that it was accepted on the first round. Not one. That's not anecdotes. Let me turn to, again, the specific property in question. Downtown Portland, adjacent to the Markham Bridge. We have property there that in the early 90s, our company, Schnitzer Investment Corp., learned that some of the property was contaminated. We tendered the matter to the insurance company at that time. All but one of the companies, the insurance companies that we had, refused to do anything. One insurer, accepted the defense of the matter, but only agreed to pay a very small portion of those legal costs associated with direct negotiations with DEQ, totally refusing to pay the substantial costs of consultants and others in terms of analyzing the issues, remediation strategies, making recommendations in terms of solutions. We obviously continued working with DEQ. No assistance from the insurance companies, although we periodically provided them copies of all the material being generated. In this case, it resulted in three consent decrees
governing the investigation, the remediation strategies, and the actual cleanup. We've to date spent over $3 million. We have yet to complete the final phase, which is an engineered cap over the site. After we had completed the initial phase, the insurance companies then approached us. And again, they were noticeably absent during this process, except that we periodically sent the material. They wanted to negotiate a settlement, but they didn't really want to pay the claim, but let's negotiate part of it. But they'd only pay part of it if Schnitzer agreed to pay for a large part of the cleanup itself, first of all, and then secondly, as a condition of the settlement, that we're going to give up any and all other rights of the policy. And if we didn't do that, they needed some other kind of guarantee that we would never bring any more claims under any of the policies relating to that same facility. That's not the way insurance is supposed to work. We pay large premiums so that if anything like this happened, insurance would take care of it. What they're doing is demanding policy concessions out of the insureds as a condition of fulfilling what's already their obligation under the terms of the policy. If you look at what this means statewide for a second, for every company that's willing and able to move forward, there are probably 50 companies or more that don't have the money, don't have the resources to basically hang in there during the process to go through the system to get to that point. And if you have the insurance, and if the insurance was being used the way it was intended, more money would be available to do a lot more cleanups throughout the state. Let me turn to a couple of the specific provisions of 1205 and tell you how I believe it will help bear on site cleanups. Among the many reasons given to Schnitzer by our insurance companies as to why they refused to provide coverage at our Moody site claim, one stands out as probably the most destructive of what the state's been trying to do over the last number of years with the state cleanup program. And you've heard about it already. That is, the reason given by our insurers is you're not entitled to any insurance because you, quote, voluntarily agreed to perform the work. That is, we entered into negotiated agreements, ultimately through consent decrees with the court, rather than waiting for DEQ to sue us to make us do the work. As a company, we disagree with that position that the insurance carriers have taken. You can see what position it leaves Oregon companies. You're between a rock and a hard place. What you basically are told by your insurance carriers, if you follow that approach, is stiff the DEQ at every step, refuse all written or oral requests to perform any of the work, drag your heels, lay in the weeds. That's the policy approach they're suggesting. We don't believe that's the appropriate state policy, and we don't believe at all that's what the coverage provides in the policy that we have. Section 4.2b, we believe, takes care of it because it makes it clear that insurance companies can't deny coverage to you if you are doing things under a consent decree rather than a result of waiting for DEQ to actually sue you. Let me turn to the issue of defense. Section 4.2f. One of our insurers, as I mentioned, agreed to accept a tender for defense. However, that carrier ultimately paid less than 5% of the cost we ultimately incurred in terms of the specific DEQ cleanup at the Moody site. Because in that case, the insurance company took the position only defense costs would have to be paid, that is the legal counsel costs. And while it's nice to say that, well, the courts have already said you can get beyond that, every claim, we're slugging it out on those points. Who can afford to slug it out? Schnitzer can afford to. I think as you see in my detailed comments, once we file some legal papers, we tend to see response up about 1/4. But the fact is, many companies can't hang in there. They don't have that ability. And even as far as whether it's large or small, we're fighting over these issues every time. That is a poor use of money. When you reference the RAND study and those 88 cents, what you're talking about, and I hate to do this for the Senate Judiciary Committee and talking to lawyers, but what we're doing is we're spending money on lawyers down a rabbit hole. It isn't money towards going towards actually solving anything. That is a concern that we have. 4.2f corrects the situation.
It says we're going to spend the money, not just for the lawyers, but we're going to spend the money to generate the information you need to be able to move forward. 42G, the excess insurers. You heard a lot about that. Well, that's cheap insurance and it doesn't cost much and don't worry about it. The fact is, this is different than a homeowner's policy where it's the same policy and the same carrier for every year, forevermore, and all that. You've got to realize that you've got many different carriers. It is site-specific, oftentimes operation-specific, oftentimes by individual year. And when you go back, I can assure you they calculate how much of what happened at that site related to that 1 year. And when you've triggered that and you are, in fact, are successful and obtained the coverage for that year, to be denied by the excess coverage because they want you to go through all extraneous, non-germane insurance policy holders, which can't provide you coverage because they weren't involved in those other years in terms of the contamination at that site, you're denied the ability to trigger to drop down and get the coverage that's required. 42G solves that. It clarifies it that an excess policy is triggered when the coverage limits of the primary or the underlying policy for the same policy period has been exceeded. That's what we're talking about. So just to summarize, I don't really know John DiLorenzo. I've only met him once or twice. I don't really have the basis to like or dislike him, but I like 1205.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Bruce Bosch, president and owner of Kemco Metal Products. We're located in Clackamas, Oregon. We have 75 employees and are an original equipment parts manufacturer for the trucking industry. Kemco has been in existence for 33 years, and in the early 70s through the mid-80s manufactured as part of its product line steel tanks. These tanks, as a part of the manufacturing process, involved a degreasing operation in which the tanks were run through a solution of TCE and degreased prior to the painting process. During that same time, the Temco maintained, paid for, and maintained all risk, liability, insurance coverage, and there were no exclusions in those policies for property damage from hazardous waste or TCE contamination. In 1997, DEQ put Temco on its confirmed release site for the TCE contamination that had occurred back in the 70s and early 80s as a part of that tank manufacturing process. The insurance carriers that provided coverage during that time frame were notified in December of 1997 concerning coverage for the investigation and cleanup costs associated with that contamination. Kemco wants to be responsible in dealing with this cleanup. We've hired consultants. However, a timely and effective cleanup is dependent on the involvement of the insurance companies providing the coverage that was paid for. As a company and a small business, we must compete with other companies in a marketplace where the other companies are not burdened with the kind of cleanup costs facing Kemco. At this point, having been notified in December of 1997, the insurance companies have yet to accept any defense costs associated with that cleanup, nor have they even agreed as to what might constitute defense costs. They just simply have stonewalled us. They're not even returning our phone calls at this point in time. So we're not able as a company, we're a small business, as I mentioned, we're not able to issue stock. The insurance companies are. We don't have a rich parent company to draw on for resources for this cleanup. And the estimated first phase of the remedial investigation is estimated to be $500,000. And while we'd like to proceed with that again, we're not able to do so without the involvement of the insurance companies. We need Senate Bill 1205, and we need it because currently our only option to be able to effectively and timely deal with the cleanup is to sue the insurance companies. Now, with all due respect to the attorneys, they will be the only ones that benefit from that kind of lawsuit. It's going to take resources that would otherwise be utilized in that cleanup. Quite frankly, I feel like we're wrestling with the proverbial 900-pound gorilla on this issue. They can afford to, the insurance companies can afford to sit back, wait, let us sue if, you know, they can drag it out. And most businesses just are not, and we're one. We're not in a position to be able to go through protracted litigation while at the same time being pressured by DEQ to proceed with the cleanup. So we need another option. Businesses in Oregon need another option to suing the insurance companies. And Senate Bill 1205 is that option. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Yes, Sarah Brown.
A question for Terry, and then I'll ask it of everyone. It's my understanding that as of 1986, insurance policies for farming have specifically excluded pollution coverage. Will farmers buy pollution coverage specifically for pollution coverage in the future? Do you see that happening?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I believe there still is pollution coverage available through one company for farmers. I think some do still buy it, yes.
Okay. And then I just ask everybody this. Do folks think that the price would go up for future policies if this bill passes?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I don't believe so.
Okay.
We operate in a number of states and have, you know, while it's true that is there a bill like this in other states? No. But there are portions that you can find in other states. We did not see, you know, when the Washington State Insurance Commissioner instituted an agreement, it was on a specific portion of the law. The end of the world was supposed to happen when that was first promulgated. That did not happen. And again, we're also talking about policies that were issued that were bought and paid for in times past. The profits were made in times past. They're there. And let's say, well, the policies have lapsed. When you buy those policies, they're good. They go out for a reason, because you don't know when a problem arises. So this notion that, well, it's like a car policy, well, I've got my driver's insurance for this year, and now next year comes, I've got to buy another one, or else I can't, you know, drive and I'm never covered. This one is different. You have that ability to look back. It was bought and paid for. So I don't believe that there is a direct relationship.
You may or may not know, but I've been working for a few years to get some insurance coverage for some specific health care, and what I hear both from employers and the insured is that it's a mandate, obviously, and that premiums will go up. So I guess, how would you distinguish this, particularly in light of the insurance industry calling it a retroactive mandate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown. Again, I think there are some distinctions in terms of a policy was bought and paid for and profits derived. Were they enough profits to cover all the costs? I can't tell you that. Certainly I can't do that in terms of, you know, the comparison to a health care policy. Presumably you're talking about health care coverage, though, going forward, as opposed to imposing something now where we're going to go back, retroactively go back and re-examine the payments made for a surgery I had, you know, a few years ago on the fire thing. So I think there are some similarities. There are also some distinctions that can be made.
Okay. Mr. Chair, yes. I assume that most of the policies we're talking about, there were not specific exclusions for pollution, et cetera, and that would be a distinction I might make.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, in our case, there were no exclusions for this type of coverage that we're seeking. And again, We're just simply looking for not something retroactive or looking for to go back and rewrite the policies as it's been described to you. And just to the contrary, we're merely looking for a means to be able to go back and recover the policies and the coverages that we paid for a couple of decades ago. And again, the insurance companies have had opportunities to invest those funds, invest those profits, and those coverages were paid for. And, you know, we're not looking for any kind of rewrite. We need assistance in being able to deal with the insurance company. Right now, they're writing the rules.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, one of the issues that brings to mind your analogy is I had a product liability claim on a product that I sold in 1984. I called my insurance company and it was taken care of. This was just in the last 6 months. The pollution insurance that I'm claiming back on are pre-1987 policies, but they aren't affording me the same coverage on a claim that I get on a similar product liability. And in my opinion, because it's a pollution type, which I had no exclusion for the type of claim that I'm making.
Question,
Mr. Chair. If some environmental issue is excluded in the policy, this bill would not cover that.
Correct.
An exclusion is an exclusion, and this doesn't state that it covers
that. That's my understanding. Thank you for your testimony. I now would invite up Lana Butterfield, James Perusha, Brian Bowe, and Diane Daly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Bowe, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association. OPM is a trade association comprised of petroleum distributors. In addition to wholesale, OPMA members own and operate about half of the retail service stations in the state of Oregon. We are opposed to Senate Bill 1205. The proposal was submitted to the association by Mr. DiLorenzo with the hope that we would be allies in the efforts to pass the bill. However, after reviewing the matter and hearing presentations from both proponents and the opponents, OPMA decided they could not support the bill. It may be curious to some why an industry so burdened over the past 15 years with high environmental costs would choose to oppose such a bill. The explanation lies in the unique insurance requirements that petroleum retailers are subject to by federal law. Every station must carry $1 million worth of pollution liability insurance coverage on their underground storage tanks. This requirement has been in place since the late 80s and initially caused great hardship for gasoline retailers. Congress, in its wisdom, decided that all USDs needed to be upgraded and the properties cleaned up. This past December 28th was the final deadline, and as many of you know, stations were forced to close because they could not afford the cleanup. Prior to the cleanup deadline, an additional requirement was placed on these small businesses. This was the financial responsibility law that required the $1 million worth of pollution coverage. Imagine, your place of business is declared to be contaminated, you're given a cleanup deadline, and then told to go find insurance. As you might guess, the few policies that were available were very expensive, had high deductibles, and extremely limited terms of coverage. After sites began to be cleaned up, the prices of these policies started to come down. Terms improved, competition increased. One of the many damaging consequences of the federal underground storage tank mandates appeared to be improving. Enter Senate Bill 1205. The primary reason OPMA is opposed to Senate Bill 1205 is the impact Section 4 would appear to have on those who must purchase pollution liability insurance, such as petroleum marketers. As written, this language would have the effect of mandating these expanded coverages. We are told by our insurers that the provisions in Senate Bill 1205 for things such as voluntary cleanup, no notice requirement, and other impacts will have a very significant impact prospectively on the cost of this coverage. That, Mr. Chair, should be of concern to this legislature. The state has invested millions of dollars in assisting rural gas stations with the expense of upgrading their facility so that fuel will remain available in these remote areas. Cost increases in the federally mandated pollution liability coverage could very well have the effect of putting rural stations out of business. Their volumes are so low, there is no way they could absorb large increases in their cost of doing business.
The retail gasoline industry has experienced a tremendous amount of upheaval over the past 10 years. Today, now that the 1998 deadline is passed, things are slowly beginning to sort themselves out and settle down. Forcing a solution through the legislature that solves one problem only to exacerbate another is no solution at all. Throughout the past decade, we have attempted to forge public solutions to public problems, such as the underground storage tank cleanup requirements. The problem posed by properties unknowingly polluted many years ago, but now requiring expensive cleanups, is only slightly different than the one faced by gas stations. It is widespread and financially disadvantages, sometimes seriously threatens the viability of those companies who find themselves the current owner of these properties. However, Senate Bill 1205 envisions a very different solution to anything ever considered for the underground tank problem. Instead of seeking a broad-based public solution to the problem, it would force a private solution. Rather than attacking the various elements that create the situation, it would simply transfer the liability to private insurers. The problem with that, Mr. Chair, is that someone ultimately will have to pay the price. Insurers will not absorb these extraordinary costs without somehow passing them on. Petroleum marketers appear to be front and center as a potential target, and for that reason, we urge the committee to reject Senate Bill 1205. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I defer now to Diane.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I'm going to go next. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here representing Safeco Insurance Company. I can do John Powell one better. I sent a little note to John DiLorenzo during the interim telling him I thought he was a great guy. Of course, that was before I saw Senate Bill 1205. With me is Jim Peruca. Jim is the regional vice president of Safeco, that region being comprised of Oregon and Southwest Washington. He's going to be presenting our position. However, I do need to bring one point before you, and it's because the proponent of the bill told me last week that he was surprised that Safeco was so opposed to this bill. I think he doesn't realize just exactly who this bill might impact in the insurance industry. And so that you won't be surprised by it, I have given you a look at our market share in relation to commercial liability insurance products. You'll see that Safeco is number one for commercial multi-peril liability policies and number two for standalone liability policies in Oregon. This tells you that Safeco has a very big interest in Senate Bill 1205, and we are strongly opposed to it. The proponents have shown you the trees. Now we invite you to understand the forest. And who better to do that than a person with 35 years of practical hands-on experience in this marketplace?
Thank you, Lana. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Peruca, and I am the regional vice president for the Safeco Insurance Company in Lake Oswego, Oregon. I'm finding all new meaning to the terms vertical exhaustion and horizontal exhaustion tonight. I imagine what you must be going through here. Since you've got my written testimony, I want to hit a couple of bullet points, and you can read the detail. Our concern is that there's potentially several impacts, and you've heard some of those over the course of the evening. As a result of Senate Bill 1205. First of all, a wave of litigation likely as Senate Bill 1205 is challenged and the time and expense that comes with that litigation. Secondly, if 1205 is upheld, some large losses would enter the system. There's a lot of sites out there that are owned by polluters and or people who have purchased polluted sites that the insurance company would likely be forced with the expense of the cleanup. Large corporate owners would then end up with what could conceivably be prime property in the future at the insurance company expense, and there is even the potential for fraudulent claims. We just want you to realize, and I've talked to some of you about this in previous visits, and the fact that insurance is a pass-through mechanism. The losses will pass through the system if the losses are increased, and they will be spread throughout the business community. Not only that, I think that many times policies will be subject to stricter scrutiny by underwriters as they look at what is likely a different and the more unusual exposure that they face in Oregon. Because Senate Bill 1205 is so unique, a potential precarious to withdraw is there. I think that the avoidance of business is a possibility, and small commercial insurance insureds who need coverage, such as farmers and dry cleaners and gas stations, could be impacted. As workers' comp reform in 1990 took us down a positive road to lower rates, I just would like to state that I think that 1205 got the potential to head us down a road where we're reforming contracts, we're changing the ground rules, and I think it's got the potential to be damaging to not only the insurance industry, because, again, it's a pass-through mechanism, but to business in general. So Safeco would urge you with the 1205. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Daly. I'm an attorney with the Bullivant Hauser Bailey Law Firm in Portland. I've been in practice for 18 years, and for the last 10 of those years, I have focused my practice primarily on insurance disputes arising out of claims for environmental damage. And I am here today to testify against Senate Bill 1205. I do not have a written testimony for you. My purpose here really is to simply supplement some of the comments that were made previously by Mr. Gordon. I represented two of the insurance carriers who were sued by Mr. DiLorenzo on behalf of ICN Pharmaceuticals. And I am quite concerned that this legislation really is the outgrowth of the dissatisfaction by ICN Pharmaceuticals, which, by the way, is a California corporation that doesn't do business in Oregon any longer, to persuade an Oregon legislature to overturn very well-researched and well-reasoned rulings by Judge Keyes and other jurists in this state. I don't want to reiterate the testimony of Mr. Gordon or to point out the same things that he pointed out, but there are a couple of additional issues that are raised by this proposed legislation. With regard to exhaustion, I won't go into the whole issue of horizontal versus vertical exhaustion, but if you do look at the proposed legislation, one thing that is particularly troubling is that it would allow for exhaustion of a primary policy without true exhaustion. The proposed legislation specifically states that a primary policy will be considered exhausted even if all the policy limits aren't paid, which would allow an insurer to settle with a primary insurer for, say, $150,000, even though the limits were $500,000, and then turn to its excess carrier and demand the excess carrier then step up to the plate, when that is completely contrary to the terms of any excess insurance policy. So in a sense, it is rewriting that particular provision of an excess insurance policy. With regard to the prejudice issue in the proposed legislation, as written, that would expand the ruling of Car Chevrolet, and it would severely limit the right of an insurer to do investigation or to rely on two primary sources of dispute or of bases for determining whether there is coverage under an insurance policy, and that is the cause of environmental contamination and the timing of third-party damage. These are liability insurance policies we are talking about, and coverage is applicable only if there is third-party property damage. That is one of the key issues in these types of disputes, that as I read Mr. DiLorenzo's proposed legislation, an insurer would be precluded from relying on a lack of that type of information as a basis for establishing that it has been prejudiced. I believe it is somewhat of a red herring to suggest that this proposed legislation would do away with any disputes between insurers and insureds. The fact is, as I believe Mr. Gordon stated, these types of claims are very fact-specific, and they need to be investigated thoroughly, and that many of the times there is a dispute between an insurer and an insured, it is because of a disagreement about the facts. far less than there is a disagreement about the meaning of the insurance provisions. So I do not believe that enactment of this legislation would, in fact, do away with disagreements between insurers and insureds. There also is a concern that by treating this contract of insurance differently than any other contract of insurance, you run the risk of financially exhausting liability insurers through the payment of claims that were, in fact, not intended to be covered by the policy, and thereby depriving the insured of liability coverage for other claims that really are covered by the policy. I believe there was a mention of a products liability claim, which also would be something that an insured would tender the defense of under a liability policy. However, if that policy has been exhausted by the payment of, say, an environmental damage claim, which really wasn't covered by the policy, the insured then has no liability coverage for such a products liability claim that would, in fact, be covered under the policy. So it is, in fact, endangering coverage for otherwise covered claims. I am quite concerned that the testimony and the legislation is, in fact, a diatribe against the insurance industry as a whole, and I was concerned by some of the comments of the insurance industry turning its back on insurers. And in fact, many of the businesses that have testified here today, and I have been personally involved in some claims filed by them, have in fact received a great deal of payment for liability claims made under liability policies. If the insurance industry, by disputing the coverage for this particular type of a claim, is not in fact turning its back on its insurers. They are providing coverage for many other types of liability claims that, in fact, are covered under those policies. One issue and problem that is presented if this legislation is enacted is how do you treat those other claims under these policies? Do you apply to those other claims, which may not be environmental damage claims, the same conditions that are set forth in this bill? Do you adopt this definition of a suit for a non-environmental damage claim that's made under a liability policy? In a sense, you would almost be forced to, but it would be turning on its head the language of the policy. Therefore, I would certainly urge this committee not to enact Senate Bill 1205. Thank you.
If you'd like to submit any written testimony, the record will remain open, so you're free to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for this panel? Yes, thank you.
I guess I just want some help understanding exactly insurance in this particular realm. When Senator Brown mentioned health insurance, I've come to understand that health insurance is actually prepaid medical costs. We all know that we're going to go and get coverage through our health insurance policy. It is not you probably can get catastrophic insurance, but health insurance in these days is not really insurance as has been or was conceived of in the 40s or whatever. But it seems to me that liability coverage and the kind of insurance that we're talking about, an insurance company will assess the risk. Isn't that true? Don't they assess risk before they write the insurance?
Mr. Chair, Senator Akita, and maybe Brian would like to comment on this too. Assessing the risk takes place in the insurance industry, particularly the liability insurance, in a very fluid environment in that the laws change. The laws change on product liability, the liability of liquor servers, and so as an insurance underwriter assesses the risk today, it's not in contemplation, say, of a Senate Bill 1205 or of a change of some other type. So the losses then develop over time based upon the claim itself and the changes in the law, and then that distills itself out into the rates that are charged in the future for similar liability coverages. Does that make sense?
It does, okay. Mr. Chair, but except that when you're talking about, you know, they're fluid and they decide, and when bills like 1205 come along, then they make other decisions. That isn't the kind of risk I'm talking about. I'm talking about the actual on-the-ground risk, that there might be a contaminant, and you take into account what kind of business it is, and when that, and where it's located, what things they use, and then you determine what this policy is going to cost them, and unless you exclude environmental things, that would be covered too. It is a risk, and when I buy a car insurance policy, a policy for accidental insurance on my car, I don't expect to go have an accident, but I do expect that if I do have an accident, certain things will be covered, and I'm assuming that my insurance company bases the risk upon my age, my driving record, the kind of car I'm driving, maybe even the color of car I have, whatever, but they have determined what the risk is and then write the policy and charge me for that risk. That is different than what Mr. Bowe was talking about, because he's talking about an insurance policy after the fact, where they know there is environmental damage. Very, very different, I think, from what we're talking about in 1205. But this is, your situation sounds to me more like health insurance, where you know you are going to use it, so it is prepaid coverage.
I think so. And I think the concern, and it all kind of links together, and the concern that is raised by insurers is that the retroactive aspects of the bill assess a liability for a risk that was not underwritten. And it's, in spite of the testimony that Mr. DiLorenzo submitted, I don't think that insurers were aware of the impact of TCEs and things like that, or other common business practices, such as dumping used oil out behind the service station. That's what they did with it. They dumped it on the ground. And there was no awareness that 30 years later that would impose a huge liability. Prospectively, the concern is for petroleum marketers that now that liability is opened up and we have to buy that coverage as a condition of doing business, that pass-through cost that Mr. Peruca is talking about is going to be turned over to us, mm-hmm. in part.
Well, I do see, Mr. Chair, that they were a little bit aware by the documents that we have in this book, 1944, 1963. They knew about some of the possibilities.
The biggest risk is always the change in technology and what legislatures and Congress do, too, with the EPA and the DEQ. Some of the older insurance policies, of course, were in existence before those laws were passed, imposing strict liability. And, of course, once there was some experience under that, the policies changed to usually provide an exclusion unless you pay a higher premium or have a relatively safe business. So without the fault of the insured or the insurer, there is a liability that now comes under the contract that was not anticipated necessarily by either side. And that's what we're going to deal with as far as public policy. Any other questions for the staff? Thank you for your testimony. Chris Herman, Jerry Bitt, Rick Pope, and Jim McDermott. And as you come forward, we appreciate your being here tonight. This is an important issue for my committee's been going since 3 this afternoon. So,
you're not planning on working with us tonight. Okay.
Why don't we begin with Chris Herman? Whoever you like to begin with.
I would be first, Jim. Yeah.
All right. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jim McDermott. I've submitted some written testimony. I'm a partner in the Ball Janik firm in Portland. For the last 12 years, I've had a very active practice representing corporate policyholders, individual policyholders, and governmental policyholders in disputes with insurance companies. I've sued probably well over 100 domestic insurance companies throughout the course of my career, as well as hundreds of fund and syndicates and London market companies. And I also tried the first environmental insurance coverage case in Oregon to a jury in 1994. And I've submitted some testimony, but I want to respond primarily to what the insurers' lawyers were telling you here. Mr. Gordon was telling you, we don't need hard and fast rules. We need, this is all fact-specific. It's very complicated. That's nonsense. And let me illustrate it by, if we take a look at Oregon's history prior to the McCormick and Baxter decision. McCormick and Baxter was decided in 1996 by the Oregon Supreme Court. I wrote the amicus brief, friend of the court brief, for AOI, Associated Oregon Industries, advocating the result that the Supreme Court reached. Before 1996, if you had a pollution claim in Oregon, the response uniformly was, no coverage, we're not paying, a cent, sue us, but we're not paying. After McCormick and Baxter, the result now is, they'll pay something. Not a lot, probably not 50%, unless you sue, but they'll pay something. And since 1996, I have not had an environmental insurance coverage case, but I've had to file in this state, and it's because my clients have all agreed to take something. It's typically been less than half in the aggregate, but it's been something. And what this bill does is it greatly increases the negotiating leverage for policyholders, especially the allocation provisions and the exhaustion provisions. Because what happens is if you have a situation where the carriers have to allocate the responsibility for the cleanup among themselves, as opposed to the policyholder have to going to each carrier, and in lots of these cases there may be 20, 30 insurance companies on the risk. You've got to go chase down each one. And you go to Safeco, and they say, well, we wrote 5% of the risk, and you know, if you give us a complete policy release from everything, from any other claim in the future, maybe we'll give you a 3% of the of your problem here. And what happens is, and then you talk to them, and they find out what each other does, and then Safeco says, Allstate didn't pay you enough because of the allocation question, or for some other reason, or because, well, they were an excess carrier, and you didn't exhaust the primary limits enough, and we have that defense, and plus you gave us late notice, and had you told us earlier, maybe we would have investigated, and maybe we would have paid more, but we can't. What this bill does is it creates by legislative amendment what I think the landscape will be in this state in 10 to 15 years.
Through court decisions.
And this places Oregon squarely within the majority of states on the allocation question. I've cited some cases in my materials. But what this does is essentially gives us some hard and fast rules in the pollution environmental insurance area. Hard and fast rules that have been adopted by courts in other states. It's a great bill, and I support it wholeheartedly, and I urge you to do the same.
So why should we legislate and not just let you litigate?
Here's why. I'm part of the rat hole that Mr. Zielenka was talking about and spending money.
There are several of us up here who are.
I took a lot of money from corporate policyholders that I really shouldn't have to take, because no insurer is going to pay an environmental claim unless you have a lawyer. And a lot of them aren't going to pay a lot unless they get sued. And in my case, I think a lot of insurance companies know I'm going to sue them if they don't pay something. So we're able to work it out. But the insurance industry has an enormous litigation advantages with the expenses and the resources it can devote to these claims. I've litigated $700-800 million pollution claims in the late 80s, early 90s. And the carriers will pay their lawyers millions of dollars a year, because if they can delay the payment on that claim by a few years with the time value of money, they've made a bundle. And typically, then they can get out of it for 75 or 80 cents on the dollar, because policyholders will take 75 or 80 cents on the dollar just to be done with it, just to get the money now as opposed to 5 more years in the future. And with the time value of money, that ends up being about half of what they should have gotten had they gotten the money when they made the claim.
Thank you.
If I might, before I pass the microphone here, in my testimony, there are a couple of other provisions I'd urge you to consider. There's an attorney's fee statute in the state, ORS 742.061, which allows policyholders to recover attorney's fees if they win. There's a concurring opinion by Judge Hazelton, which talks about how the courts interpreted the statute to mean that carriers used to have to tell you what they pay you before you got sued. Now they can offer you, okay, on a $1 million claim, we'll offer you nothing. You sue you. We'll offer you $250,000. Halfway through the litigation, $500,000. Then $750,000. They can offer it right up to the point of judgment and deny the policyholder's right to collect fees. And Judge Hazelton characterized that as a primal scream result. And he, in his opinion, said, the remedy, if any, lies not in judicial ingenuity, but in legislative amendment. And I urge you to consider that. And the statute also uses the words just attorney's fees, does not use the word costs. And to bring a piece of coverage litigation costs a lot of money with expert fees and court costs and depositions and the like. And if that additional word was in the statute, it would make the policyholders whole if they win their coverage litigation, as the statute is intended to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Good. Thank you. My name is Jerry Bitts, and I retired as the Chief Financial Officer of Cascade Corporation about 3 years ago. However, I stayed on as a consultant to Cascade Corporation because I have wanted to see through an environmental claim that I initiated for the company 11 years ago. That claim has not been settled to this date. Now, I'm not a lawyer, and I can't speak to you in precise legal terms. I just want to tell you what happens when a company makes a claim and tries to collect on the promises that the insurance companies made to us back when they sold us their insurance policies. As I said, I'm not a lawyer, but I am a CPA. I worked for Price Waterhouse for 5 years before joining Cascade in 1967, where I worked for 30 years. One of my first assignments at Cascade was to take charge of the company's insurance program. I've been continuously responsible for the company's insurance policies for those entire 30 years. And I've often reflected on the way the insurance companies treated us as customers when we bought their policies. I recall their promises to defend and protect us and to take care of us. One company even flew us to their corporate headquarters in Fort Worth, Texas, put us up in their best hotel suites. They wined and dined us. They even made me an honorary citizen of the city of Fort Worth and gave me a key to the city. For background, let me tell you something about Cascade Corporation. Cascade is a publicly traded company, headquartered here in Portland. We manufacture materials handling equipment, and that's large machinery that fit on the front end of a forklift truck. Our devices pick up all kinds of goods and all kinds of applications. And in this region, the most familiar product would probably be our paper roll clamps that would be found in paper mills all over the Pacific Northwest. Cascade is a homegrown operation that started out as a machine shop doing defense work during World War II. The company struggled after the war, but it gradually outgrew its small plant in the Northwest Portland. And in 1956, we built a new plant out east of Portland on Highway 84N, out towards Troutdale. Now, Cascade is not a huge corporation. In 1996, the year I retired, our sales were just under $220 million. Over the years, our company had to follow our customers around the world, and so we did establish three other plants throughout the United States and three plants in Western Europe. But despite that, our Portland, Oregon plant remains our flagship plant. And from there, we sell our products all over the world and export a considerable amount of our production to Asian and other foreign countries. Our corporate headquarters is also located at this plant, as well as our engineering and our testing facilities. In 1956, the Portland plant was a greenfield development. We were surrounded by small produce farms and a few homes. Our products are made from raw steel. In the manufacturing process, we fabricate, we weld, we machine, and finally, before we paint the products, we have to clean them, degrease them. You've heard already tonight about TCE, and that was the solvent that we used about the time we established the plant in 1956. And I've learned since then, over the years, that TCE is the most commonly used cleaning solvent in metal manufacturing industries throughout the United States and also in Western Europe. A number of authorities, including the American Insurance Association, recommended disposing of the spent TCE by pouring it on the ground. It was supposed to evaporate in the air. The vast majority of it did, but a tiny amount did sink into the groundwater and did contaminate the groundwater. Now, Cascade started having its spent TCE hauled off by licensed disposal firms in the early 70s, and it discontinued using TC entirely about 1975. We didn't know about contamination until 1987, when the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality started doing some testing of our industrial supply well. In late 1987, when I first learned of the DEQ's investigation, I immediately informed the insurance agent who had sold us the insurance policies over the years. 6 months later, in May 1988, the DEQ initiated a consent order action against Cascade. And the insurance agent at that time reported this to all of the insurance companies, all 10 of them, who had sold us all risk comprehensive general liability policies from 1956 on. So what do you suppose the response of these insurance companies was? These insurance companies who had promised to take care of us. Well, one company denied that the policy existed at all. Another company insisted that there hadn't been any damage, that Cascade had not incurred any damage. All we were doing were investigating. Two other companies declined coverage, and four companies didn't respond at all. Six other companies did not respond at all. Not one single company honored their promise to defend Cascade. And in fact, one company actually sued Cascade. Now, how do you think we felt about our insurance companies? The fact is, we felt that we were betrayed. Those promises didn't mean anything. We went on reporting over the next 4 years the activities of DEQ in their RIFS, Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study process. And in May 1992, after 4 years of silence from the insurance companies, we finally initiated the lawsuit against all 10 insurance companies. Under the terms of their policies from 1956 to 1986, at first, they simply stonewalled us. Then they tried to get the court to throw out the case. When they finally realized they had to respond to our suit, they replied with some 50 affirmative defenses, accusing Cascade of every imaginable charge, including defrauding the insurance companies. And I took that one personally. Mr. DiLorenzo has already listed a number of these affirmative defenses, and they sounded very familiar to me. And so I'm not going to repeat them. But due to these roadblocks and many other roadblocks, it took 5 years of enormous effort to finally bring this case to trial in 1997. There were more than 25 hearings prior to the trial. More than 100 persons were deposed, some more than once. And some of those depositions went for several days in a row. I personally was deposed 6 times. The transcripts of my depositions totaled 904 pages. The trial lasted 13 weeks. The personal burden on our company, on the managers and executives of our company, was so intense that it was very difficult for the company to carry on its business. Cascade's legal fees will amount to something between $4 and $6 million before this case is over. The financial burden on Oregon taxpayers for the countless days and weeks of the court's time for all these hearings and for the 13-week trial is enormous. There are obvious reasons why the insurance companies throw up these phony defenses. First of all, they simply don't want to pay the claim. Their goal, as has already been stated tonight, is simply to wear the policyholders down. And perhaps they will run out of money. Even if they ultimately pay the claim, the stalling still pays off. Again, as mentioned earlier, the longer they can hold on to the money, the more they can earn on their investments. With the last several years' stock market returns of 20 to 30%, you can see that the insurance companies win by stalling. To get back to Cascade's claim, the case actually came to court in the summer of 1997, 9 years after the claim was filed, 5 years after the lawsuit was filed. By this time, Cascade had already paid out $13 million of its own money. Now, four primary insurers finally agreed to settlement after they had tried to wear us down just prior to the trial, as they say on the courthouse steps. Four excess carriers went through the entire trial, but they finally agreed to a settlement just before the final arguments to the jury. That left two insurance companies in the case. And finally, in September of 1997, the jury returned a verdict in Cascade's favor.
For what amount?
That amount has not been determined yet. The judgment has not been rendered.
Didn't the jury come back and give the dollar amount?
It did not. The judge reserved that decision to herself.
So they found liability, and now the judge has to define the dollar amount?
That's correct.
You're going to ask for attorney's fees?
Pardon me?
You're going to ask for attorney's fees?
We certainly are.
I bet you are.
The judge in the case, do you know the name of the judge?
The judge's name is Judge Nellie Johnson. Well, as you said, the judge has reserved the right to determine the amount of the judgment against these two companies. And incredibly as it might seem, of course, these companies have not paid Cascade a single cent, nor have they raised a finger to defend Cascade. Now, there has been talk about the matter of allocation, and that is certainly the issue that is holding up the final judgment. And in this case, it's a matter of the insurance companies fighting each other, fighting Cascade, fighting the court over who pays what. And one thing that they do agree on, however, is that Cascade should bear the largest part of the loss. Now, as I understand it, Oregon has conflicting court decisions on this question. And from what I've read of Senate Bill 1205, I believe it would clearly help to resolve this issue. The last point I want to make, we've heard here tonight that insurance companies have stated that this legislation, Bill 1205, will result in increased premiums. And based on my 30 years as a buyer of insurance policies, I say this is absolute nonsense. It's nothing but a scare tactic. The liability insurance market is a national market. In fact, it's an international market. It's very broad and it's very competitive. Over the years, there have been soft markets and there have been hard markets. During periods of limited capacity, insurance premiums go up. That's the hard market. During periods of soft markets, when there is excess capacity available, insurance rates go down. It's simply a matter of supply and demand. for the past 10 years, despite the fact that there have been environmental claims under the Superfund law, the insurance markets have been soft. They've been soft for at least 10 years. There have consistently been year-to-year premium rate decreases. Everything I have read suggests that this soft market will continue for the foreseeable future. So I urge you, don't let this premium threat scare you. It's just not going to happen. And I thank you very much for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you for your testimony. Good evening. If you could identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Pope, and I'm an attorney with Newcomb, Sabin, Schwartz, and Landsberg in Portland, and I was the lead trial counsel in the case that Mr. Bitz has just told you about. So I feel qualified to correct him on one point, and that is
not at all.
I'm
not
an attorney. But the jury did award a $14 million damage calculation. The judge, though, has to respond to many arguments that the insurance companies raised after that award on the allocation point. She sent us off to settlement and mediation. Then there's been extensive briefing over this allocation question. There's no clear guidance under Oregon law about how to allocate, and so we still don't have a judgment. So the case is not over yet. And this bill would give the judge clear guidance in resolving this issue. If we had this bill 5 years ago or 10 years ago, our litigation would not have gone on for 11 years and still not be concluded. It would be over by now. It would be over at much less cost to Cascade. It would be over at much less expenditure of time. I have back in my office 15 lineal feet of motions, legal motions in this case. I measured them before I came down here. It's like Alibaba. You can't count them. You have to measure them. They're so voluminous. And we would not need 15 lineal feet of motions if we had this bill. And the way I see it is the 50 affirmative defenses that Mr. DiLorenzo talked about are 50 roadblocks that the insurance companies throw up in the way of their policyholder trying to prevent recovery. Now, this is backwards from the way they usually handle a claim. My written materials go into this in more detail, but they're trained to find coverage. That's what the books say that they go to school to learn on. Your job is to find coverage, not to find controversies, not to deny coverage, but to find coverage if it exists. But they've all formed environmental claims units, and the good people who work for insurance companies, and I've deposed a number of them during this case, aren't in those environmental claims units. The fire breathers are in the environmental claims units, the people that go from house to house, because out there in the real world, to bring one of these claims, it's house-to-house combat. And every time there's an advance, they fight it house by house by house by house. And that's why it's taken us 11 years to get to where we are. Now, as an impact, one impact of this bill, a beneficial impact of this bill, I saw it in the newspapers today, and it's attached to my materials as tab one. It's in the Oregonian. EPA wants a tougher DEQ for river cleanup. And some of you may have heard that the EPA is looking at cleaning up the Willamette River Harbor and thinking of declaring the river that when I came to Oregon in 1980, it was, Oregon has cleaned up the Willamette River. Well, now the EPA is thinking of making it a Superfund site, and they're saying that DEQ may not be qualified to lead the cleanup because DEQ is going to rely on voluntary cleanup by the businesses along the river, and EPA doesn't trust a voluntary cleanup program. Well, I have to say that a business that enters into a voluntary cleanup program with the DEQ to clean up the Willamette River is running a serious risk of forfeiting all their insurance coverage for that cleanup. And EPA's concerns, as expressed in the newspaper today, given the liability insurance argument, are valid ones. And this bill would remove, I think, a big incentive from businesses from participating in a voluntary cleanup program. So that's one example in the news today as to how this bill could beneficially affect public policy and allow that cleanup, give it a better chance to remain under Oregon control. Now, I am the lawyer, so I love this bill. I love the concept of this bill. I would much rather be representing a lot of people bringing claims that don't last 11 years than one person that has one 11-year claim. And there are, I think, some language issues that could be improved in here, and I've pointed them out in my written testimony, so I won't belabor them now. But one thing, because of our Cascade's unique situation and the fact that we had a jury verdict in September 1987 and we still don't have a judgment, it so worked out that the judge instructed the jury on determining what's indemnity and what's a defense cost, and they went through actually 69 pages line by line of Cascade's expenses and characterized them as defense or indemnity. And I have one copy with me back in my briefcase. They wrote unanimous or 10 to 2 or whatever it may be. Well, under the way the effective date of this act is written right now, it's possible all that work could go to waste because it says if a case hasn't been reduced to judgment, then we'll apply this law. We have a verdict that set indemnity versus defense under different rules than this bill says. The jury decided a lot of the RIFS were indemnity costs. We have no quarrel with that, and I won't go into the details why, but I'm concerned that without some minor changes, that this bill could inadvertently take away our jury verdict before judgment has been entered. So the simple solution is to say it applies to cases that haven't been sent to the jury yet. A better solution to give the judge the benefit of these rules, which would be very helpful, would be to, as I propose in my written materials, which I've submitted to you. Now, the only thing I'd like to take any time on, I'd like to mention a couple things, but the allocation issue, I would commend to anybody who's interested, tab 4 in my materials, that's the testimony of Professor Richard Roddus in our trial. And he explains why there should be joint and several liability for insurance coverage in these environmental cases. And he goes through the history, he goes through the language of the policies, the fact that they promised to repay the insured for all sums that they must pay as damages because of property damage. And I would like to just tell you Professor Roddus's qualifications. He's a former insurance commissioner of the state of California. He's a former professor of insurance law at the University of Washington. He's a former dean of the University of Washington Law School. He's a former president of an insurance company. Professor Roddus knows what he's talking about when he lays down these rules, and he cuts through a lot of the smoke screens. The allocation of joint and several liability follows the liability of the policyholder. If you have liability insurance, the insurance has to cover the same liability that the policyholder has. And if the policyholder has continuing, unsevered joint and several liability, so must its coverage be that way. Now, there's some other of the 50 affirmative defenses that aren't addressed in this bill that I wish were addressed in this bill, and I won't go into them. They're in my written materials, but you see them. A lot of them fall away by the time you get to trial, but these are some of the ones that still stay by the time you do get to trial, and I would like to have the opportunity to work out language that would address some of these 50 roadblocks as well. Because the whole name of the game, as far as the insurance company is concerned, is if they can hang the policyholder up on one of these 50 hurdles, only one, there's no coverage for anybody. On the late notice issue, and the qualified pollution exclusion is a big problem, and that's in my materials, and if you have time and interest, I would ask you to look at that. On the late notice issue, I come down as a bit of a skeptic. The actual case law protections that Oregon has now are really quite good. And I'm concerned that this bill doesn't state enough of those protections that now exist under Oregon law. And I'm concerned that the insurance companies will then argue, because they're masters at turning everything around, that because this bill didn't list all those protections, then the case law protections that were there don't exist anymore. Now, I've submitted at tab two, a red line markup, and page five has some additional language that I would propose to really put late notice protections in there. But if the committee isn't inclined to do that, speaking for myself, I'd rather see the subject not addressed. Oregon case law is good. These proposed changes would be better. They address the situation of insurance companies that don't investigate at all, don't have a policy of investigating, and then claim their prejudice. Well, they shouldn't be allowed to do that. They should have to show, if they're going to claim prejudice, that they're set up to look into these claims in the first place. We have testimony from one company, and then I'll end, who said, we have never paid an environmental claim, ever, in our history. And they're one of the two that's still left in our lawsuit. So that's what I have and in my materials, and thank you for the opportunity to let me testify before you.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Chris Herman. I'm a lawyer with the Sol Reeves Law Firm in Portland. And for a good bit of the last 12 or 13 years, I have been in the environmental practice group at Sol Reeves. And because of that, I have the perspective of a lawyer who works day-to-day with manufacturing industrial companies in Oregon that are going through the DET process. And also because of that, we have day-to-day experience with those same companies trying to get the cooperation of their insurance carriers to assist them in paying for the cost of complying with the DEQ requirements. I don't have any prepared written testimony I'm submitting tonight, and rather than even going through the prepared remarks I had looked at, I just wanted to focus on a couple of the issues that I think are of paramount importance, and in part they're issues I've heard raised in questions and addressed in some responses, and I just want to focus on those if I can. The first thing I wanted to say is that the practices that Tom Zielinka described to you earlier and that some of the other witnesses described tonight in terms of the process of, you know, lengthy denials, repeated requests for documents, you know, basically a long, drawn-out bureaucratic process which ends in a denial is, you know, is widespread. So, you know, whatever the insurance industry believes or will testify to the proceeding tonight, you just have to understand the reality is that the experience of companies like Permapost and Temco and Schnitzer, and I could name 25 others, is that they get dragged through that process. And at the same time, they have DEQ project managers pounding on them saying, you need to get going right away, you need to get going right away, because what happens if you don't? And this is the first thing I really want to focus on. There's been some discussion about voluntary cleanup agreements and the voluntary cleanup program. It's critical that everyone understand that there is no such thing as a voluntary cleanup program or voluntary cleanup agreement in the sort of conventional sense that we think of voluntary. The way the DEQ process works is if you have a site or DEQ believes or suspects that there is has been a release or there's been a potential for releases, they send you a letter. They say, look, we have information that suggests that your site may be contaminated. Now, you've got three choices. You can go into the voluntary program. You can give us $5,000. We'll provide oversight. You can basically try and do this cleanup on a streamlined basis, but you're going to do it under DEQ oversight. Secondly, you can go into the site response section, which is a sort of traditionally was a sort of heavy-duty treatment for companies that had an environmental pollution problem. And historically, what that meant was that you entered into a consent order that the DEQ gave to you, which you had minimal opportunity to negotiate, and you performed the investigation and the cleanup under that provision. Or your third option was do nothing, and eventually DEQ will get around to doing its own investigation and clean up, and then when they do it, they'll assess you treble damages. Now, none of those three options are what we would, I think any one of us would reasonably normally consider voluntary. That isn't to say that the companies don't have responsibility for cleanups, and in most cases, they will, in fact, step up to the plate and do something about it. What we're talking about is whether companies that pick option one, which in theory is the most speedy and cost-effective option for themselves, for the DEQ, and for everyone else in the state, should be penalized because they've taken that option rather than digging their heels in, as some folks have talked about tonight, enforcing both DEQ and any third parties that may be concerned, neighbors, whomever, to wait until the process sort of eventually grinds through. So again, voluntary cleanup program, voluntary cleanup agreement, that's sort of a term of art. It's not really voluntary. But certainly for those companies
that step forward, they ought to be, you know, rewarded rather than penalized. And what the statute is trying to do, or this bill is trying to do, is just to acknowledge that. Because as you've heard tonight, and as Rick has just mentioned too, companies that, that are in that position, they go into the voluntary student program, will absolutely guaranteed hear about it in that denial letter that comes. It'll be on that list of 50 reasons why they don't get coverage. And we just want to put that behind us once and for all. There's been some comments by some of the witnesses tonight that would suggest basically that we don't need this bill, that everything is fine in the world of environmental cleanups and the world of environmental, you know, cleanup liability insurance coverage. That just simply isn't true. If you look at the policies, and it's critical, we haven't really talked about the policies tonight, the insuring agreement is typically for one small paragraph, and then you have pages of conditions and exclusions. And what happens in every one of these cases is that when someone comes forward to make a claim, the insurance company sees on each one of the provisions in the insuring agreement and then all of the conditions and exclusions and say there's no coverage for all of these reasons. We don't have Oregon law that addresses even, you know, most of those provisions. And so each and every time you go into one of these cases, and the reason that Cascade has taken 11 years to go through this is that it is a battle on an, you know, a tremendous number of points. What this legislation, proposed legislation, is trying to do is just to sort of clear the deck so that we can deal with the factual issues that are unique at each site. But in fact, the policies tend to be fairly uniform. I think as Tom Gordon said, these really weren't heavily negotiated for the most part. They're standard form policies. The insurance industry began developing back in the early part of this century as a product to sell to commercial and industrial enterprises in this country. And that's critical because what were they selling? They were selling, as you've heard tonight, an all-risk product. What does that mean? What it meant was, again, you get coverage for any third-party liability except those coverages which are expressly excluded. A number of the issues that we're talking about in this legislation really trying to, again, set the record straight, whether it's allocation or duty to defend. These are all issues, as you've heard tonight, that you deal with every time. We just want to get them nailed down and people can move on to applying them to the specific facts of every case or each case. On allocation, there's been a lot of discussion about whether allocations proposed in the bill, the sort of so-called vertical exhaustion, which really means that if I have 25 or 30 or 40 years of coverage, if I am, let's say, Temco or Permapost or Schnitzer or Cascade, and I've got a $10 million cleanup, I can just go, if I have one or two policies that have limits of $5 million or $10 million, I can just go to those policies and say, please pay. Now, what you might say is, well, why is that fair? I mean, if there are 20 or 30 or 40 years of coverage, why should we do that? Well, the reason is it's not just a matter of you have joint and strict, or rather joint, several, and strict liability in the environmental area. In the language of the policies, there are specific provisions which support the provision that's in this legislation. So what I'm talking about is the typical CGL policy insuring agreement, which generally provides the insurer will pay on behalf of the policyholder all sums which the policyholder shall become legally obligated to pay as damages because of property damage. And it moves on. In other words, the agreement itself, the basic contract itself, makes clear that each carrier is buying onto liability rather to insure and reimburse for liability up to the full measure of the limit of liability. So there's no reason why I, as a policyholder, should have to go and chase 20 or 30 different carriers over X years. I really should be entitled to go to whatever policy I want that has been written with that language in it. And if those carriers then have equitable arguments among one another, this legislation, proposed legislation, does nothing to preclude them from fighting between one another. And if you spend any time at all, and I don't know why any reasonable person would, but those of us who do this work spend a lot of time doing it, you look at all the cases in which the carriers are fighting with each other. Well, why are there all these cases? Well, because they know as well as the rest of us that they have rights as against one another. Let them implement those. This doesn't prohibit that. It just takes the policyholder out of the mix. And that's really what the policyholders are entitled to under the policies that were sold to them, and that's what we're asking for here. And again, you know, all sums, as well as some of the other arguments you've heard tonight, really support the language that's in here. It's not only fair, but it is in sync with the policies as they were written. One other thing that was mentioned is the duty to defend, and I'll stop with that. The duty to defend issue, and this again relates to why we need this legislation. Yes, the McCormick and Baxter case made clear that in the context of a cleanup in the state of Oregon, you don't need a lawsuit filed against you as a policyholder in order to qualify for the duty to defend. The problem is that that particular ruling is expressed in the Court of Appeals decision, which means that I tell you, I have, I think, right now 10 of these cases. Every time I talk to insurance carriers, and right now I'm talking to them every day and saying, when are you going to start paying for the defense costs? The response I get from them is, we don't have to pay for defense costs in Oregon unless there's a lawsuit. Why not? We have them informing and back to the decision, I say. Their response, oh, but that's only a Court of Appeals decision. Supreme Court hasn't said that. And until the Supreme Court says it, you don't have to do it. Well, how can you say that? Any trial court in the state would be bound by that. Oh, well, our in-house coverage counsel in Hartford and Boston, wherever they are, telling us that that's the way we ought to interpret this. So if you don't like it, sue us, which leads to the problem that, that Rick was talking about, which leads to the problems we have with the Willamette River cleanup and many other cleanups, which is that anyone who's dealing in this area knows that to get significant money out of carrier, you have to sue them. That's not a fair way, and it's not a necessary way for this whole process to unfold, and it's one that's definitely detrimental to cleanups in this state. And by the way, DEQ, I believe, has reviewed this bill. In my understanding, I know Kurt Burkholder, who's an attorney in the Department of Justice, has reviewed this bill, is supportive of this. At least he told me to support it because DEQ recognizes how critical it is to cleanups that that there be prompt payment under policies that were written to cover this very sort of risk. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the testimony. To let you in the committee know, DEQ has signed up Lori Onan, if I pronounce that incorrectly, forgive me, and she's Czech neutral. We have three additional witnesses. The chair's choice, because of the hour and all these people are in the building frequently, is to not call them tonight but invite them back at another meeting. Those three are Steve Telfer and Steve, I know you're frequently here. This will give you a chance to rewrite your testimony if you want to argue more of the points in just a second.
Okay.
And then Lori Onan from the DEQ and John Ledger from AOI, who also is Czech neutral. Questions of this panel before we adjourn?
You all, in terms of lawyers, have talked about the sort of hassle that the civil litigation has brought, the number of affirmative defenses, the piles of paper. I haven't done any civil litigation, but isn't that fairly typical of most civil litigation cases, sexual harassment, product liability, whatever?
In my experience, it's not very typical because typically you're litigating against a host of insurance companies, so the volume of paper is multiplied because it's not party A versus party B. It's party A versus 10, 12, 15. I've had cases where there are 125 insurance carriers.
But isn't it true that the same dynamic sort of takes place as if you've got a woman suing a company for sexual harassment, for example? It's, you know, a little person A versus big company B or something, and so B company tries to overwhelm little person A. Okay.
No more non-Christian books for you.
These are large, complex commercial litigation cases, which in my experience are different.
Was that any different than the
sexual harassment cases?
The case that Ray Thomas just tried against the tobacco industry, against one of these tobacco companies that I won't name.
Philip Morris?
Yeah.
That case is probably comparable to large-scale insurance coverage suit, yeah.
I've never had another case in which there's been anything close to 15 lineal feet of legal motion.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one more question. This is actually for John DiLorenzo, but you guys are sitting up here. And I guess, what's the public policy reason why we exempted environmental claims from the exemption on the getting rid of the joint and several liability? Why the specific exclusion from the abolition?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, the specific exclusion came about because there were political constraints and we were instructed by the chair that we were allowed to do certain things, and that was one thing we weren't allowed to do.
I was the chair back then.
Thank you.
I think it was to get a signal. The questions for this panel committee, I want to thank you for your patience. I think you found it to be very interesting. I feel like I need two law review articles and staff also for being here, also you and to the witnesses. Thank you for your time and effort. This is important, and we'll give it a thoughtful process. So we are adjourned.